much for coming on time. I'm sorry the equipment just wasn't ready when we could have started, but now it is up and running, and the old story, for want of a nail, in this case for want of a cord, we couldn't start. But welcome to everyone. There is a certain procedure that we want to embark upon this morning as part of the deliberations on the company's amendment bill. But very briefly, in terms of apologies, first of all, I'm not aware of any apologies on my desk. So I'll... Yeah, but I haven't got them here. No, we haven't got any apologies on the desk at the moment. I do only have two or three members. I'm not sure. I'm just looking at the arrangement that was made with the committee's chair for them to leave at midday or something. I'm not sure. So perhaps you wanted to speak to that, did you, Honourable Mabasa?
Yes, I'm on the chair because we are supposed to join economic development, so we would be happy if the meeting can end between 12 and 1, you know, just to make that attempt.
We did try to accommodate that, and I'm sure we have accommodated exactly that. Thank you very much. So, I will immediately... there's an apology from the whip here that Chief Whip has granted him leave so that he can attend to provincial political business. Now, what we're going to do here is hand over immediately to the committee secretary just to explain one of the processes that we sought advice on, and we were advised initially that certainly there was absolutely no reason with the may and the must and the mine, but subsequent to that, we have found, although it is not covered by rule directly, that it would be advisable, given the substance of the bill, to go this procedure. So if you'd like to outline that, and are the requirements for the committee, Mr. Herman?
At the request of the chairperson, we inquired about the process regarding going forward with respect to the company's amendment bill. There are amendments that is outside the scope of the bill, and we sought advice on that matter. Although the rule 249 implies that we may seek the approval of the House to amend any matter outside the scope of the bill before us, we thought that we'll get the legal opinion from our legal services office just to get a view from them on how they would, what would they, their opinion be on the matter. I think the committee will distribute their opinion. On page 2, he said, I'll just read what he says. He says, Rule 249 of the National Assembly Rules regulates how a committee may process a bill. In this regard, Rule 249.3a provides that the committee must inquire into the subject of the bill and report on it to the Assembly. Rule 249.3b, however, provides that if it is a bill amending provisions of legislation, the committee may seek the permission of the Assembly to inquire into amending other provisions of that legislation. Despite the use of the word may, read in its context, it notes that the committee must first seek permission of the House before inquiring into amending other provisions of the Principal Act. He then advised the committee that the committee must seek permission of the House before proposing amendments to the Principal Act. So that's where the process is at the moment. So the committee needs to then make a decision, and we then can table an interim report to that effect, seeking the permission of the House to amend amendment in the Principal Act, which is not before us at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Having listened to the secretary's explanation, I move that as a committee we take such necessary steps. Thanks, Colleague Chair.
We have a mover. Can we have seconders for this, please?
Madam Chair, before, sorry, point of order.
Honourable Lambertini. Well,
point
there's no need to do a point of order. You acknowledge.
Thank you. Now, before we hasten to curtail debate, I've seen an average of bad opinions coming out of the table, and not recognized to be bad opinion. You've just given us a three-page document, which excerpt has been read in a very uncertain tone of voice, of possibly betraying his own personal discomfort with what he was reading. I'm reading that into his language. You are the psychologist, I'm not. But my immediate reaction to what has been said, I haven't read this, is that I strongly disagree. And to a certain extent, the analysis of what has been said shows its fallacy. Every time we are amending a single word of the bill is introduced, we are amending the principal act. So what does that mean? Does it mean that if we have an amendment on section 26 of the principal act, we can amend everything else in that section, but not in section 27? Does it mean that if it is 26.1, we can only amend it to 26.1? So it is section-driven, or is it content-driven? Scope is about content. It is a semantic approach. This is what we are talking about. It's a subject matter. The subject matter of the bill before us is the entire bill. I mean, I dare anyone to define a specific subject matter, a specific policy. There are things which address insolvency, things which address the technical corrections, other things which are there at this auditing. Each and every aspect of the bill that we have discussed in terms of scope and in terms of subject matter, I submit to you that it is a fair subject of amendment. Now, this is my opinion. I haven't read this piece of paper. Very likely somebody will move and will vote and I'll go in the minority. So I will want my position to be recorded, and I said the safe place, is that the safe way of playing it out, and why? If by accident I'm right, which it has happened in the past that I am, then this process becomes flawed. And why vote? Why do you want to curtail discussion? If we want to amend something else, let us put the amendments. You guys have the majority. You can do anything you want to do, but do it by the rule. Let's stop playing with the rules to get your way through. So if I want to put amendments, let me put that through and you vote me, or anyone else, and you vote me down.
I think unfortunately, I must regard some of the points you've made as points made because you did not benefit from some of our earlier pieces of information. We actually, this has not been the first time this has hit the desk, and it's been the second or third. However, it's not a question of the committee not wanting to pass the amendment at all. As a committee, we've spent many hours reaching, we haven't yet adopted everything, but there's been no desire and I think no intention by any member in this committee to say we're not going to pursue certain amendments. We've actually looked at the substance and the motivation for the amendments. And we've gone ahead and pursued these. So I must say, I certainly would disagree with your analysis on this. I have, as chair, shared everything with you. As a matter of fact, this was addressed to me personally because I requested it in the absence of something. But it is not my habit. I don't have a style which moves towards secrecy, but rather transparency. So I see no reason why I shouldn't share something with you. But quite frankly, all of the three pages, you needn't have seen. The reason for this is that certain clauses were not consequential, and we've raised this ourselves from time to time. Let's just check. One or two have been required because they were not covered in the amendments, and as you quite rightly say, we're entitled to amend. We are. But there are a series of these amendments, and we just need to alert the House through its own procedures. Did someone else have their hand up? Honourable Klobasa?
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I do want to totally agree with the approach that you are coming up with. First of all, we should not treat this bill as if it's a new bill altogether that is before us.
Chairperson? I think with the persuasive skills of the secretary, let's ask the secretary to go and utilize those skills. I know he's a winner.
Chairperson, I was saying, let me try and speak a bit louder. I was saying that we should not treat this bill as if it is a new bill altogether. It is an amendment to an existing act. That's the first point. If we follow the line the Honourable Ambrosini is putting through, we then are going to amend this whole bill and take on even clauses that are not proposed for amendment. So I'm cautioning that we understand that this is an amendment to an existing bill. That's point number one. Number two, submissions have been made by members of the public. And on the basis of those submissions, we together with the department have gone on to effect amendments, new amendments, informed by the submissions of the public. But thirdly, we have also said in this committee that should we recognize a certain clause which was not under amendment, which requires now an amendment as consequential to an earlier amendment, proposed amendment in the amendment bill, then we should go ahead and do so. If we now begin to bring in new clauses and want to amend even the clauses, first of all, which have not been part of the amendment, secondly, which have not been considered as a result of the submission made by the public, and thirdly, we simply amend, but not because the amendment, we are proposing an amendment consequential to an earlier amendment, so that we are consistent with the amendments that are there. We are then beginning to treat this bill as if it's a new bill altogether. We are amending an existing act. And where it is not necessary to amend, let's not come up with new amendments which are either not affected by the by the inputs of the public during the public hearings, or which are even not even consequential to the earlier amendments that we are making. Otherwise, we are not going to conclude this. By the end of this process, we will have rewritten the whole bill, and as if it's a new bill, when it, in fact, we are amending an existing act. If it works, why fix it? Thank you.
Sure.
We had a proposal on the table. That proposal was to move. We asked the seconders. Honourable Salam.
Chairperson, I could have done this earlier. but I wanted to give an opportunity to the collective in respect of the different political parties to also second. But I understand that the composition of this committee is not necessarily a committee of parties. It is a committee of parliament. And therefore, I now second.
Clerk, on the motion before the committee, please.
We had a seconder. Are there any objections?
I request it to be read, please. The motion before the committee.
The interim report of the portfolio committee on trade and industry should have been done before.
The portfolio committee on trade and industry, having considered the subject of the company's amendment bill, B40-2010, that seeks to amend the Companies Act 71 of 2008, wishes to seek the permission of the Assembly to inquire into the amending of other provisions of the Principal Act in terms of 243B of the Assembly Rules. We've done this already, but we'll just read it again. 2493B. Right. So we have proposer, agreement, and no objections. Is that correct? Right. Thank you. Can I ask you to explain now the process forward again to members? After this is signed, where is it going?
The report will be tabled to the House for consideration, and I think that the first sitting of the House will be on Tuesday. The 8th set will be on the order paper for consideration.
I think they're waiting to hear you in the
line. Oh, I'm sorry. I think the intention is to have this on the order paper on Tuesday, because that's the first sitting of the Assembly. And then the House will make a decision on the request of the committee. Thanks.
Members, you will understand we're not adopting the amendment bill as such. What we are doing is seeking merely the permission of the House to, and I hope that's very clear, to inquire into amending of other. That's all it is. Simply a process, a procedure that I believe is the best that we pursue in this instance, given the substantive nature of the some of the amendments here, proposals we've taken out of the public hearings and made. I see this personally as a formality that will go through the House unless someone raises a constitutional objection, and then we pursue things as they go along. We have legal opinion that says we needn't even do that. But in this case, I prefer to be a little bit more cautious. So now we come back. That absolutely required our full quorum, and we couldn't really release anyone at that stage. We're now back to the deliberation. Okay, so we haven't yet got to the adoption of anything. I hope members understand. flagged issues within the ambit of the bill, has everyone got document 18? 18. Isn't that called 18? Everyone now should have what was drawn up for all of us as requested yesterday. Document 18. Well, you should have 16 and 17. They were issued yesterday. It wasn't they, because when did you issue them? Oh, yes, says they have not yet been distributed yet. Right, can you distribute them, please? Because members can't get given an 18 when we haven't got the 16 and 17. Number 16 is our consultant, Kathy Idenson, suggested wording for the final version of section 136, etc. All right. Number 17. Honorable Andrew Keeney.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
No, I'm just giving this to someone
now. I didn't realize that you made yesterday.
I'm fine.
For some reason, I didn't receive the notice of meeting yesterday. That's why I was not here.
Well, we send it, through the committee secretary, and then we got an apology from Honorable Labemia, so we assumed, all was in order. We can just address those. I must say I did have the benefit of getting this last night myself. And has everyone now got in front of them? Clause 6, the symbols issue. Has everyone got it? Are we looking at document 16? 18. If you look at that clause 6 symbols, I've ticked it, but let me hear from you because in examining everything here, we had addressed every aspect of the symbols. There was one issue that we were going to address further on about this, and that was 5th or something, and I asked you to make a call in that respect. So over to you, DTI.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We managed to get the contact details for the SWIFT office in South Africa. It's up in Sandton in Johannesburg. I've called that number at least 5 times since the chair's instruction, and the number goes directly to a voicemail. It seems like it's like a representative office of some sort, and it's not staffed because it goes directly. It doesn't even ring. It goes directly to a person's voicemail. I've left numerous messages there. But what I've also done, Chair, is that I've managed to find the contact details for the SWIFT office, the international SWIFT office, and I've sent them an email as of late yesterday afternoon, putting out exactly what the problem is that we're seeking to seek an answer on, and I'm still waiting a response on them. They have not responded as yet to my email. I spelled out exactly what it is concerning that. But what we also did, Chair, is, and this might assist and might not assist, until we wait for the answer, is that we've also done a little background on exactly how the SWIFT system works. There is a bit of some documents on the internet concerning how the SWIFT system works, and it seems to work like this, is that it is firstly only dealing with banking institutions, and institutions have banking licenses, so it's not a movement of funds between companies themselves, company to company. It's a banking technology system. And secondly, what it says is that if the bank has some sort of a name or a symbol or whatever else is contained within its name, that is actually not the identifier. Yeah. They've got a unique identifier that SWIFT systems work and interact with. It's like, for example, Chair, the example we use is that even though you might call me Rory Voller, I've got an ID number. And if I identify with somebody else using my ID number, it's irrelevant what you call me. Because the interaction is between ID number and ID number. So when the SWIFT system works, to us, it seems that if it works on unique identifiers within the SWIFT system, so whether the company has a symbol in its name, it seems like it's an irrelevant thing. But we will still get some feedback on that. Yeah.
Thank you. Ms. Idemson, do you have anything to add in that regard? No. I must say, for all its name, SWIFT seems to belie how it actually operates. It certainly, your inquiries have not been swifted. Yes, Honourable Mabalsa.
No, I think given the attempts that have been made to get more information, we should move on the basis of the information that we are having, and we should no longer allow it to hinder us. And then we should then say, as we go on, should the department get a response which further enriches the interpretation, they will then indicate to the meeting, to the chair. But without that, let's move on the assumption that we have the information that we need. I mean, as far and so that it doesn't hinder us.
No, thank you very much. I think that takes us a little forward as well. Honourable Ambrosini, Honourable Smalley.
Yes, thank you. I don't remember what the name of the symbol is, the act. How was it sold? The end. What's the name of the symbol? Ampersand. There was an issue whether it should be in or out.
Look, we dealt with all of that. Honestly, Honourable Ambrosini, I think you can get the Hansard now. Because we can't go backwards when we've actually marched over that territory. Let's just now get on to clause 6. We are on symbols. Honourable Smalley.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not happy with moving it along because Advocate clearly said that they are still trying to get one or two issues, you know, in writing. He sent out an email, and that will actually put a actual foot forward. I am happy in the case where the minister actually determines the symbols on this regard in the regulatory factors, and in that case, if it should be in a negative response into when we say these are the symbols that has got to be responded, hopefully the minister will then take that into account to say that the systems do not talk to each other, or they do talk to each other, and therefore we cannot then introduce it. It doesn't say we have got to do it. It says we can do it, but the minister has got to agree to the symbols that can be agreed upon, and therefore on that sense. I still await for the outcome on that to make a full pronouncement on that, but hopefully it will be taken into account at the regulations as well. But thank you, Tim.
Put it this way, I think what we're saying, we're moving on. However, should something come to light on the consideration, I think that was my understanding of the Honourable Mabasa, certainly we won't ignore it. When I say we're moving on the symbols issue, much of it is now ticked up there because it's covered in regulations, with the only outstanding issue was the SWIFT issue. And as we go towards the final consideration, if that remains an unknown situation per se, having looked at international practice as well, we would accept that the studies we've done have not hindered the operation of the legislation, because you have the principal legislation supported by secondary legislation, and regulations can be changed much more frequently than, of course, legislation. So I think it is on that basis we're moving forward. Right. Clause 16, page 38, line 37, insert right to copy. I've ticked that. We have already done that. I think some of us should understand when some of these issues were flagged, we called for responses back from DTI. And we got back the response itself. And I'm sure you all recall the issue of the right to copy. And that, in fact, has been inserted. Clause 37, summarized or full financial statements. The big issue was around, they've got to provide the financial statements anyway. And this is a small company. You know, we're supposed to be aimed at targeting, trying to assist small businesses and emerging businesses. Why should we put further burdens on them and ask them now to summarize this as well? By all means, full financial statements, yes, and if you wish, attach a summary. But the view that we already expressed is that it should not be mandatory.
Yeah.
Right? So we move on that. Clause 41, minimum number of directors. A number of issues came up on that in that respect. It's clause 41. And we seem to have, between the department and our own consultant, we seem to have had adequate responses there. So I've got a tick on my right-hand side, which may mean that someone may have disagreed or whatever on the matter. Clause 41. All right. Clause 43. No. You shouldn't have just said you told them. You should have actually banned them. Some people don't need to learn all that much diplomacy. the disqualification of directors. That we dealt with in depth, clause 43, we did get changes made to that. You may wish to just look at clause 44, that was the social and ethics, because there were strong views that we should have it, and in other instances that it may not be necessary. So do you want to look back at that clause again, clause 44, which was the amendment. From your document to the amendment bill. You'll see that there on page 27 of the amendment bill, that a category of companies that must each have a social and ethics committee, if it is desirable in the public interest having regard to. So I would want a ticket if I can now. I see none. Yes, Honourable Pani.
No, just for confirmation, it is we are this bill seeks to ask bigger companies or companies with public interest to have the ethics and those committees, the social and ethics committee, and I think just want to support that if it's, you know, on that it's not for the smaller individual companies that are coming up to lot, and I think it's just to understand it in that light. But thank you, we do support that, ma'am.
Yes, I got the impression we had all supported it, you know, because I think in today's business, the public and private sector, an ethics committee is vitally important. We've just established one here in Parliament, as you know. Right. Now, clause 47. Payment of fines. You know, that was the issue. I've got that line where we said, you know what, it was initially only directed, it would seem, at the national people and national legislatures, and we wanted it to also be covered in provincial. Do you remember that point that was made? So let's just get that one up. That is the fines and clause 47. And the big issue was right there, probably in A, on page 30, line about 9 and 10, stretching from about, I suppose, 6 or 7 until 10, that any fine imposed on a director of the company, etc., or related company, as a consequence of that director having been convicted of an offence in terms of any national legislation. Did we want to leave it in terms of national legislation, per se? Would that be the way to go? Because someone raised this, would this then mean that it was possible for people at another level or sphere of government, you know, not to cover that? I'm also just looking here at the consultants, but we've got our consultant with us, you see. So, you don't even have to look it up, she's going to be right here. But if you look up the issue here that is referred to, clause 43. I've only got clause 43 here, and then I go to clause 48. So it didn't really come up then as such, the consultant. So we don't want to leave it as it is, do we? Do you want to just comment there?
Yes, thank you. I would propose if you deleted, in fact, all reference to legislation, and so that the provision would cover a conviction for any common law or statutory offence, whether it's at national or regional level.
Did you have that in one of the documents? I don't recall that, you see. So as we go through this then, Margot, where are you? Yes, you just fill that in. But once you've done it, let's just read it out, because we're now adding. Everyone's in agreement, are we? Yes. So put it down.
Just listening to the DTI's response as well, in this regard.
Pardon? You want to listen? Have you got it down then already?
No.
Yes, because you see, let's put it down so we can all see it, and then we'll get DTI's response. That's what I'm asking for. So that's clause 47 in respect of the fine, payment of fines, offences of directors. And that also gives DTI the chance then also to get together.
I also raised the issue of that void that came into factor where the where it interlinked with section 218 and section I think it was 78 where the accountability issue should also be raised, where the person also still is being held accountable, or the director is still being held accountable for those actions. And my understand, I know when we will bring in the two amended bills A and B together, the rewriting or the wording still has got to come into effect in how we can address that issue, so that we can still hold that director accountable for his actions even though he's not there anymore. And that's where the void issue should have come into play. I just would like you just to, Chair, ask my request is that the wording in that sense also needs to be addressed.
Right, let's just first deal with this one though, Honourable Smale. Are you ready to respond, DTI?
I'm sure we actually support concerning the removal of the aspect of only dealing with national legislation, because it goes much wider than that.
Yeah.
So we actually agree with that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the
yeah.
Point is that we would take off having been convicted of an offence. Is that it?
Yeah.
So,
if I may interrupt, are you happy that the provision would then cover common law offences as well?
What kind of offence are we talking about now? It'll be worded all right.
An offence,
you see. Just, and then delete in terms of any national legislation. So, we're on page 30 of the Amendment Bill, clause 47.
Question. What type of offences would this language now not include?
No.
Do we really?
All offences. But, you know, when you say this, all offences, it's really, why even pay a traffic fine for that matter? But, I mean, I'm being facetious. It's covering all offences.
I mean, basically, moving violation. Traffic violation would exclude. I mean, is that what we want?
We don't want anything excluded, frankly. Why should a company be forced to pay what an individual director has incurred? But it's more than that, of course, and I think that's the issue, isn't it? It's not simply the individual director, is it?
May I raise an issue just for clarity? There is legislation in the environmental field which creates strict liability of faintness, usually for directors. I seem to remember that it is in waste management in some form of pollution. So company will conduct an activity, will incur a fine. The people responsible are the directors. Isn't that a situation in which it would be reasonable to indemnify the directors?
Well, look, that's on the table. Let's just hear what other honourable members have got to say. Albert, and then followed by Honourable Salam.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think Honourable Ambrosini has a point there. I think where there's a matter of strict liability, in other words, you found guilty without having had a mindset of guilt or having acted negligently, I think one should actually not be held accountable. Actually, you're not accountable, but one should not be forced to pay the fine yourself. The company should actually stand in for that, especially if it's done in the course of the scope of your employment.
Can you just give me an example?
Well, Honourable Ambrosini just mentioned the strict liability provisions in the environmental legislation.
Pollution
and those types of things, yes. So a director might be held accountable, but he might not have been the person who has acted in that regard, and also it doesn't really matter what his mindset was, he's being held accountable without having to show or to prove that he had a mindset of guilt or that he acted negligently.
I seem to remember, Madam Chair, if I may, that in respect of the transportation of hazardous materials, the company and the directors are liable for the fine if something, you know, a truck breaks down and overrolls and spills out hazardous material.
Honourable Salam?
Madam Chair, I have a problem that we want to try and look into court situations within the Act. You know, because this leads us to begin to analyze the difference between the company and the director. At what stage do you say this is the company, and at what stage do you say it is the director? It cannot be that everything wrong that the company does is blamed on the director, or even an accident, like a truck falling and spilling the oil, damaging the environment, as you say. Because of that accident, the director is responsible. Some of these things can be justified and be discussed in court and can be handled. But all the intention of this law is to say directors cannot go on making offenses and companies paying for them. They must pay for themselves for the offenses they do. Not that when the company is finding itself in any kind of an offense in terms of a particular act, therefore the director must pay. It doesn't imply that.
Thank you, Honourable Salah. Ms. Idenson?
Thank you. I think there are two issues that you need to consider in relation to this clause. The first is, which sources of offences do you want it to cover? Common law, national statutory, regional statutory, or all of them? By deleting the words in terms of any national legislation, you are covering all sources of offences. The next issue is, what types of offences do you want it to cover? Do you want it to be limited to just offences involving fraud, dishonesty, and willful misconduct as per section 2 sub B? Because this is really what it's all about. It's about trying to deter directors from doing things that are dishonest, fraudulent, or willfully wrong. If that is what you are trying to do, limit it to those kinds of dishonest offences, then you could solve the problem by, after the word offence, adding involving willful misconduct or a willful breach of trust.
We have a proposal given to us by our consultants with reasons behind it, and one comes back to, what is the intention of the Act? What are we trying to achieve? What is this particular clause trying to achieve when it comes here? Essentially, it is saying you break the law, and quite frankly, why should the company pay for you? That's the basic intention. Is it only to do with you break the law in terms of, you know, trust? Or is it if you break the law yourself, break it? We're not talking about an accident, but break the law. And I think it's a very, very difficult point to decide on. And we may want to, just for the moment, put a flag on it so that we're able to just clear our heads around that one more. And I'd also like to spend some time just thinking about it, because we don't want to detract from the intention here at all. Honorable Mabasa?
I second what you are expressing, Comrade Chair, and we should also note that the company itself will also have regulations as a company, which will be done to be in line with the Act. So I propose that we put it aside and we go to the next item. Thanks.
Honorable Ambrosini.
My approach on this is the one I suggested the last time. It shouldn't be in the law in any case. It should be in the memorandum of incorporation, because if we the shareholders want to pay for the director, it's our business. In other countries, you've got this piece of legislation, the tax law, where you cannot deduct payment made for fines to your director as a corporate expense, but it's a tax matter. If we want my company to pay the parking fines for the director, so why shouldn't we? Why should we be prohibited by law from doing that?
Jay, I think most of our concerns is actually addressed with Section 4, you know, Section 78, but bullet point number 4, that actually talks to the the Memorandum of Incorporation, where it actually deals to what expenses the company would then come up with. And I think that's where our answer lies in that part. Yes, I agree. We can flag it. We can go and think about it. But I think our answer lies in bullet point number 4. But thank you very much.
Right. At the end of the meeting, before we close the meeting, we'll take a firmer position on this one, and that's 47. Clause 54, let me see what I wrote here. No, ticked. Clause 54. Clause 55, the employee share scheme. We were able to tick that after we had accepted the proposal put forward to us by DTI. Clause 68, I can't remember what that was myself. Clause 68, right. Ah, yes, that was to do with, I think, FSB and others and the access, etc., and who would be doing what. So that was also responded to. Can you get that up, please, Margot? Clause 68. Mm-hmm. Right. Then clause 80. Is it this? I said it refers to that, but it was responded to by DTI, and we accepted the proposal which was put forward. That's what I'm saying. I can't just read that there. We also, you know, other approvals are still required and should consider spelling these out, Idenson. Yes, Honourable Hannibal.
Do we have the new wording then? which includes the spelling out of the approvals that are required. Is that in one of the DCI proposed documents? Okay. Which document is that in? Because that was an amendment.
No, I'm not reading it yet. People must go a lot.
We just need to see this.
I think the DPI has to be my of the 15th. I said we spell it out. I think the DPI has given some news. Yeah. Yeah, it's on page 5 and 6. But the I was agreeing with the DCI. No, not in the bill. In that, no, not in that bill. With you in that lucky sort of, the one of the third of say of... Yeah. Summary of submission. I'm talking about in here somewhere. No, there's more. Here. That's the wording.
I'm just preparing. The only note I've got here is one for the Honourable Smalley, who actually seemed to acknowledge it was for the other section, but on 69. We had the disqualification issue that came up. I'll just check with Kathy if she came up with anything. But there was nothing. No, absolutely nothing. I'm wondering. Just give me a minute while I go through my notes from last night. The only thing that puzzles me, I didn't put a tick or a dash. A tick would have meant that we had passed that, we'd got a response, but the dash would have meant we haven't got it yet. But as it doesn't have either, I really, perhaps someone even can, I think we can all just assist each other here, because I've got no query on it, which led me to believe it could even be 69 that should have been flagged. Yes.
To my recollection, 68, we got advice from Ms. Iverson that she believed that we should spell out in the section the necessity for the approval from other regulatory authorities.
Yes.
Now, what I'm asking is that that would then be an addition to this section 68, clause 68. And I haven't seen in the document that we received from DCI that new wording. That's what I'm saying. I may be wrong.
No.
Because according to document 14, this is the latest document from DCI, from what I could, is it not? It's not in here.
No. At the time when the approval thing had come up, and I will allow Ms. Iden to speak in a minute, we had asked the issue of the whole thing about the FSB solves all of these issues that come up, and they had we were initially told the certain engagements had been conducted in that regard, and there were certain agreements between the two, Treasury and themselves. And even during one of the meetings, Treasury raised an issue, and I said they needed to go back to DTI and thresh that out, and then DTI would come back to us in that regard. At the same meeting, of course, I think Ms. Idemson then made that particular comment about the approvals. So the point is, DTI have not come back to us because their comment at the time was that it is all covered. You see, so we're at this juncture where they're saying to us it is all covered. Ms. Idemson is saying, well, possibly there are other approvals. Perhaps you could just indicate the other approvals you were referring to. Does DTI's response remain? It's all covered.
I would confirm my earlier view that I think it's important to spell it out in the interest of clarity exactly what other consents might be necessary. There is some suggested wording to do that available in document 9, which is the stakeholder submissions. The FSB has put forward some proposed wording that does spell out all of the other approvals which might be necessary, and I'm saying it would be a good idea to go along with that kind of wording and spell them out.
John, I might just fix the attention of the committee also on section 1164 of the Act itself. Where it states the notice of amalgamation or merger must include 116 subsection 4. And then paragraph small Roman 4 of paragraph A of that subsection 4, where it requires that the notice of amalgamation or merger must include confirmation that the amalgamation or merger is not subject to further approval by any regulatory authority or any unfulfilled conditions imposed by or in terms of any law administered by the regulatory authority. So it really covers,
yeah,
in essence, what we are looking to achieve by listing a list of pieces of legislation. That is our view.
So what you're saying is that the overarching points made here in the Principal Act would cover all these other sections.
We believe
that. Right.
I'm not disputing that it's covered. I'm just suggesting that in the interests of clarity and certainty, it might be advisable to really spell it out for people.
Madam Chair,
if you look at this here, for example, I will come to committee members. This is document 11. Document 11, page 5. In terms of 116 of the Act, the implementation of amalgamations and mergers require the approval of certain specified persons. There are also various other statutes that require the approval of certain regulatory bodies for certain amalgamations and mergers. For example, and a long list there, if you've all then got that, 11 in front of you, page 5, it mentions insurance schemes, security services, and the FSB's approval for amalgamations and mergers within the insurance and financial service industries. The Banks Act requires the approval of the Minister of Finance for amalgamations and mergers involving banks. It has been suggested that Section 116 be amended so as to expressly refer to these additional approvals. That's why we have that phrase put there. The question I've been asked is whether the powers or mandates of these other regulating bodies are affected by the Companies Act. I presume that the real issue of concern is whether the Companies Act, whether the Company Act's failure to expressly refer to the need for the approval of these other regulators implies that the approval is no longer necessary. The short answer is that the fact that there is no express mention of the other regulators' approval in the Companies Act, etc. So if you've got that and you read that, I think we come back to the point that continues to be made by the consultant, that it may be better for clarity if this was spelt out. This is also in terms of the general principle of statutory interpretation, that statutory provisions must be interpreted as altering existing law as little as possible, unless they do so clearly and expressly. I mention also that I agree with the suggestion that section 116 be amended, as it I know has been, so as to expressly refer to the regulatory approvals. We come back to the same point that has been made over and over again by the consultants, that for purposes of clarity, it could be helpful for this to be spelt out. So it's not saying that there is a direct, disagreements, etc., but that if we are saying that our legislation that we pass now must be simplified so that all have a greater access, if you like, to the understanding and intention of the legislators. Now I'll come to members on my right and on my left. Honourable Ambrosini starting and then going down on the left. Well, you know, Honourable Mabasa, you don't know what he's going to talk about. It could be process as well. So let us just check.
If his point is one of all,
if yours
is
yours on the
actual case. No, on this point.
Okay. Anyone else on process? No. Honourable Mabasa.
No, on process, I wanted to suggest that DTI works on the clause while we proceed with the next items, and then when they have drafted the proposal, they alert us so that we speak to that. Thanks.
What we are going to get is this. We do have our own consultant who will work with us on the matter. The DTI are welcome to make a proposal if they so wish. So we are going to move on.
Madam Chair?
Honourable Ambrosini?
This is a process proposal, which is actually a content proposal, because it assumes that there is agreement on changing what was before us. The often very bad legislation is drafted because people are trying to be clear. Law is law. And if you want to make things clear, you issue a guideline, you issue a little booklet, you explain the law to those who need to read. There are no worse pieces of legislation than those which trying to explain. You cannot footnote a piece of legislation. And in reading these, to me it's very clear. And if we start listing what it is, we are going to set something in concrete, and by virtue of what we don't list, we exclude what we don't list. Those requirements change. What is the Competition Commission today? It could become the Department of Antitrust tomorrow. There could be additional requirements. It's a fluid field. And if we concretize onto today's picture, then we have got a problem. If we concretize onto today's picture and then we add an additional clause that says and anything else, then we may very well have this. So I think I'm satisfied with the way it is. And there are two issues. There is clarity, and there is expressiveness. If there is, I mean, the requirement here is expressed. There is, the requirement is not implicit. It's clearly expressed. It might not be clear, but I think it is. But I don't think there is an issue of being implicit.
Honourable Ambrosini, and we only had one other, was it two other members who wanted to add their Honourable Alberts, Honourable Smiley.
Thank you, Chair. I want to again support Member Ambrosini. if you're going to list it, you imply that it's complete. Now you create what they call a numerus clausus, and that is a dangerous thing because you know, in future, so circumstances might change. You might have new acts that come in, that new regulators created. And if you're going to have to list, then you're going to at least have to include a clause that says, or any other regulators in future. So you're going to have to create a vague clause in any case, okay, over and above the listed clauses. So one needs to be careful in that. And I think it's better to explain in terms of our current status outside the Act what approvals might be needed from which industries and which regulators, as opposed to listing it in the Act itself. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I was under the impression that you could read that also maybe refer it to Section 5 of the actual Principal Act that actually deals with the general interpretations of the Act, and under Clause D, Roman Figure 1, we did list a couple of
we did
list a whole lot of things, and one can maybe then in the wording maybe refer to that reading in with Section 5, and you know, to simplify the whole issue, and I think we that should solve anything in that regard. There were one or two one amendment that we did earlier in that section where we did add, I think, two
we
other
did
acts.
Add something, yeah.
Yes, and if this clause actually reads with that, and we should be covered in that.
I think the important point to understand is that the legislation has to be holistically read and contextualized. We were on 68, and you can see already we were reminded of the relationship to 116. We are reminded again of the relationship to Section 5. And I think what that really tells us, you read, try to read things in isolation here, we may not get the clarity that we hope to find. Nevertheless, I do think one principle has been accepted by lawyers, because I'm glad that they too understand the word evolution. And that is that when we came in 94, the legislation we were confronted with, which was written by many eminent advocates, state law advisors, they were the very first to say thank you to all those new legislators who came in with very limited knowledge of the law, who were able to persuade them to simplify their legal language while remaining legal. And I think that was no mean, easy feat for them, because it involved a paradigm shift in their minds, as well as the capacity to write clearer English. The lawyers in Chaucer's day, I can assure you, never wrote law the way you are writing it today, and you wouldn't want to write like Chaucer's day. So things evolve. However, I have the greatest respect for the work lawyers do, and I'm very pleased to be reminded every now and again of some of these legal fine points. Thank you. So we will move on 68. we will look towards getting, just asking DTI to refresh their minds on how, if any, they see proposals emerging from an improvement in this area, and letting us have anything should that emerge, and in the same way with our own consultant on the matter. But we will not, Ms. Isenson, do you wish to speak at this particular point on it? So at this point now, we're going to move on. All right, from 68 to 84, the inclusion of advocates.
In particular, because I really don't think anyone has a case
at all. Clause 84. Well, we just on document 18, you see, where that was raised. There was no opposition to that. Clause 87. Remuneration for the rescue, business rescue practitioner when a business is liquidated. That was something we grappled with yesterday, if you recall.
Yeah.
And I haven't got a tick there at the moment, but I do know that we did get responses from our proposals put forward by DTI, if I'm not mistaken, as well as our own consultants. So if anyone wants to comment further, 87.
I think that was the word.
You see, I think in looking at the consultant's opinion here, the position that was noted here in document 13. I'm just looking at this one now, simply indicates that, you know, early on we did just simply delete that one word, but later on the issue of remuneration came up subsequent to that deletion on the clause-by-clause basis. That was yesterday, and I think people were there yesterday. Remember that. Yeah. So, quite frankly, there was really only the one issue.
I think the word.
Yes?
Jefferson, I think if we can just take out the word before, that it just say that it will rank in priority with claims of all other secured and unsecured creditors. Because if we just take out the word before, it actually just means it will be taken on board with priority, but not at the right at the top.
Yeah, that's one of the areas where we went to the principal act
on that matter. And you want to remove the word priority at that point. And at that stage, there were different points being made by so many members as well. But I don't think it warrants.
Madam Chair, if I. Madam Chair.
Yes.
Madam Chair, if I may, just for the sake of the reference, this is in the Principal Act. It's on page 250, Madam Chair. And it's subsection 5, right at the top of the page there. And if I may just very briefly refer to our discussion yesterday in this respect, and I think we should be clear that based on this wording, the intention is here to grant the practitioner a preferential claim in respect of his or her fees. So whether as a matter of policy that is the correct position, but clearly that is the intention of this subsection based on the phrasing here. If we read the words will rank in priority before the claims of all other secured and unsecured, even secured creditors. So clearly there's just one intention here. Should this not be amended, the practitioner will be entitled to a preferential claim in respect of his or her fees.
The apparent wording doesn't. Shall be entitled to a preferential claim. In priority before is not good English.
It proves that those at the top of the food chain are really the scavengers.
I've had a look at it again, and all the notes I've made, that was yesterday. Did anyone have a hand up? Honorable Smalley?
Maybe the word entitled, then. Because as the advocate actually just read it now, maybe if that is what the this clause is actually trying to read, then will be then one has got to actually put the word entitled in that part of sentence then. Am I not, or do I understand him incorrectly now?
We don't want to now run around the bush, can we? Because the whole issue, let's look at intention quickly. The whole discussion yesterday in the deliberation was, should they get the first cut, you know? But then when we analyzed it, we said they would have been paid something.
Yes.
And then it was a matter of what was left in the kitty, how it would be settled. And here the law says, well, rank and priority, and the discussions went all around, surely we want to secure, you know, the best services here, the rescue. Imagine if these guys were told, well, look, we've got this company, nobody wants to touch it, because they're not going to get paid a cent. Or rather, it's not true that they wouldn't be paid a cent, they'd be paid a portion of the funds. So I think some members felt strongly that they should come last or certainly not first, and that the word priority was the problem. So I'm going to put it to you again. Is it such a serious problem, this word priority here for all of us, that we decide to amend it? And I want everyone's attention on this, because it would be an amendment to the Act. Or do we leave it there? Yes, Honorable Salah?
Jefferson, I think we all agree that this is a clause in the Act, a section of the Act, and that, as we speak, that's what South Africa is practicing. What's provided here.
But we do have a subsequent act that sought to amend it, which was not implemented. But carry on.
You see, that vacuum causes a problem, because now we've got to talk to what we don't have and what we don't know. Because it is in my view that you don't change what is working. What works must continue to work. We don't change it simply because there is an act in front of us, and therefore we must simply say this person cannot be a priority, mainly because we can be able to do so. We must do it because it is problematic.
Now, just for the record, just confirm with DTI, is this the act that was assented to but not implemented?
Yes.
It's never been implemented. That's why we're dealing with it. I've tried to, that this act was adopted here in this house. It was assented to. It was withheld. and the department came before us again to actually put an amendment bill on the Act, because this amendment bill was here now to rectify this Act which had been assented to, which in their opinion would not pass the practical test or get through any constitutional case. So it has never been implemented yet, and that is why we have an amendment bill that is consuming so much time with us here. But the thing is, I know myself what it's like to join a committee towards the end of a process. It's a very, very difficult situation. I've been put into that situation once, and regrettably in Europe, where I was addressing people by the wrong name, didn't know who was president, didn't know who was a bellboy. So I think it's a very difficult situation to be in. And all of us have been in that situation. So I can fully understand why you may have thought it was implemented 2008, but not yet. So regrettably now we are faced with fixing it. Honourable Albert.
Madam Chair, I think if I get it right, the situation that we're scared of is that the person is at the top of the food chain, and he can write his own salary, write his own check. This practitioner, can you hear me now? Okay. The practitioner can basically write his own salary in the absence of any regulations. And he decides, or she decides, him or herself, what they're going to earn. And if they can write their own salary, and then they are also first in line to take that salary. So the problem is that you don't know what they will take out of the kitty in the end of the day. And the problem might be resolved, as I said before, by looking at subclause 6, where you say that the minister must make regulations giving guidelines as to the type of remuneration this person can take. In that sense, the person would then not be able to, even though the person is a preferential creditor, would not be able to take so much out that it would be deemed unreasonable. If you don't have that in, the only recourse is when shareholders actually go to court and try to get a court to declare the remuneration unreasonable.
There was a proposal put forward, but we did have two other hands as well. Honourable Mabasa.
I want to second what Member Albert says now, because it makes sense that it mustn't be a blank check. But what would be a problem if we say the minister must, each time the regulator does work, the minister must work on it, then that becomes a problem. It means we must do it in such a manner that the minister only comes in if there's a dispute.
We could almost be getting around this if we just look at it a little differently. Honourable Kwabasa.
Chair, I think we must just satisfy ourselves that we are in agreement with the amendment of the first part of that section, and I think we agreed that the remuneration provided for in the agreement, that clause that the remuneration provided for in the agreement is unreasonable having regard to the financial circumstances of the company. That part of it, we agreed with that. I think the mix-up we have is that clause 5. Because it is not under consideration as it stands, as it is. It's not under amendment, and we want to amend it. Now, let us propose an amendment if we want to amend it. Because as I understand the discussion, we want to amend that clause 5 because of that part, as I understand, which says the practitioner's claim for those amounts will rank in priority. Is that our concern, where it says will rank in priority? Now, let's deal with that. Is that what we want to remove, will rank in priority? So that we are then able to go further to the last clause, 6, which then says we are then saying the minister must instead of may. So that we don't just generally look at the clause as a whole. Let's look at what it is that we want to remove or want to amend, so that we are focused. And that's why we are running in circles, because we are not focusing on the phrase that we want to remove there, if we want to remove it.
Right. Thank you, Honourable Kubata. I just want to draw members' attention to the first point, 143.1. Where it indicates there that the practitioner is entitled to charge an amount to the company for the remuneration of it and expenses, etc., etc., in accordance with the tariff prescribed in terms of Section 6. So there will already be that. It's just that I suppose we all have a natural, to me, it's a very natural thing when we see all these extra bonuses floating around for no work done, that we look at priority, rank and priority, and I think it really does scare us off, a lot of us. When I see that myself, I say, oh, we've got another problem here with people taking extra money. In actual fact, we won't. From what I've seen here, it says it's going to be prescribed there. And under 6, it says very clearly, the minister may make regulation prescribing a tariff of fees and expenses for the purposes of subsection 1. Now, I don't know if I'm misreading this, and maybe you'd like to clarify that for me, BGR.
Madam Chair, sorry for saying, thanks for doing our job for us and doing it so eloquently. You've taken the words from our mouth, so to speak. Thank you, Madam Chair.
In the legal profession, there are tariffs and there are hours. Setting the tariff is 50% of the problem, because then you can determine how much work you do and how many hours you spend. So there is a mechanism, which is the taxing authority, which determines whether the bill is actually correct, because the tariff itself is not sufficient if one spins wheels and spends a huge amount of time. So is there in the regulation a mechanism which would enable an affected party to question whether the hours spent and the amount of activities conducted, even though charged at the correct tariff, were warranted under the circumstances?
Well, I think what we'll do, as we're not on the regulations now, we need to raise this as something we would like to see factored in, or at the very least considered. Because I understand that the regulations are currently before the public. Is that correct for comment?
That is correct, Chair. They are before the public. We are in the process of finalizing the final draft, and we will include these comments as made. And just to add that there is currently in the draft a tariff of fees and a table of fees for practitioners.
And then just to remind you, everyone was issued with those regulations. All right. Thank you. So I don't want to go down that street. Flag issues within the ambit of the bill. Amendments outside the bill. Right. Is there anything here that we said we have to come back to? Come back to? Because we're not going to come back again. Right. Amendments outside of the bill. Section 15.2 states that it's also quite handy to have with us document 13 on hand, because it is comments and opinions given to us by our own consultants all the way along. So if you want to look up section 15.2, state that unalterable provisions are prohibited. The unalterable provisions are prohibited to be altered. Now, amendments outside the bill. So now that's not going to be in Doc 13, you see. I just realized. So the only comment we can rely on at this point will be the one, what is the number of the document? It's 19. Is that right? Document 19, Margot? Well, you only got it now, didn't you? You're going to get it now? So you didn't get it now? No, because I think he's sitting on my right, and then he never got it here. Pardon? Give me one, please. Right. Yeah, you've got one, haven't you, now? Right. Just let everyone get one, because I see no one got one. Yes, you may. You may.
Thank you very much. I have a small itsy bitsy amendment which could fall in between. I think it is within the ambit of the bill. When can I flag it?
Wasn't already here, did you not send it to the committee secretary?
It's a one-word amendment. It's a statistic thing.
It's a one-word. You see, we may have done it. What clause
no,
is it?
No,
what clause?
May I speak with for a second?
Yes.
And it's something that I'm raising, not the committee. The word shell was transformed to must in the Constitution, and has been such for 16 years. I'm very keen about restating the difference between shell and must. One is a duty within, and the other one is duty without. We are turning the country more ignorant if the difference gets lost in legislation, which is the only place where it's preserved. It's the key to understanding the difference between Kant and Schopenhauer, Beethoven and Brahms. So I will be moving, and I'm going to be voted against to transform the word must in the word shell.
What are you suggesting? Can you just explain? Because I don't think anyone can. I know that you're talking about shell.
Yes, I
and
mean we're,
you're referring
we're,
to must. Now, not, what are you referring to this in
through,
the act?
Throughout the bill. Throughout the bill and throughout the act. For the bill to be, all the mass in the bill to turn into shell, and an additional provision in the bill which turns all the mass in the act into shell. Because there is a semantic difference, it is wrong to say mass. It's duty from without rather than duty from within. If I say I must go to school, you don't know whether I will go. If I say I shall go to school, you know I will. And if we lose that difference, we lose it for posterity. And it's the place where it's still enshrined is in legislation, and we should maintain it. But that's my view, and I know that it won't be followed.
No, the question of people objecting and so on, I was just wanting to give you a ruling just on that, but perhaps somebody else wanted to comment. Honourable Mabasa?
My understanding is that terminology, legal terminology, not only legal, it's also English. So because of that, I think we must not debate it, and we must take it that it
you know, as the matter arises, the interpretation will be made at that stage, at all, so that we don't have to write it ourselves.
You know, we do have, I think it's an interpretation law, isn't that the case? That we have such a law? And I'm sure, I'd be surprised if it didn't take certain things like this into account, but I'm not saying I studied the interpretation law myself independently. But there are many times when that kind of thing crops up, and you may have an opinion on it yourself. There, Mr. Hercules.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to, from a legislative drafting perspective, we've moved away since 1994 from the use of the word shall for sake of simple drafting and using simple language, and also to differentiate between must and also the may. The use of what's compulsory and what is discretionary. And I think this is in line with international trends as well as far as simple language is concerned. Thank you, Chair. So it brings more clarity than the shell, for that matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would have said something similar along those lines. To me, it was a similar thing, you know, because I had learned English, and therefore the word I learned for someone who fixes your shoe was a cobbler. And then when I spoke among English people and I said I was taking my shoes to the cobbler, they didn't know quite why I would refer to the shoemaker, the shoe repairer, as the cobbler. So it's not that I was wrong. In fact, I was probably very, very right. But the point is, when you learn a language, you probably learn the... a few extra principles that natives in the language who learn it from their mother's breast wouldn't have to bother with. So really, you know, and that's my fault now in English, that the English I sometimes speak I can barely understand. But maybe if we could just check if we should have given you a chance for a comfort break for 5 minutes. I just want to check with you. Do you all look as if you need a comfort break for 5 minutes? Yeah, because I certainly would like to get a comfort break. Thank you. Everyone having document 19. This is the summary is the summary of issues emerging from the submissions. It's just noting different things. The response is the DTI's written response dated the 28th. The proposal is DTI's written proposal for consideration by PC Trade and Industry submitted 15. And the second response is DTI's written response dated the 10th of February, more recently. So it's simply indicating it's a legend, if you like. So when you see, go back and you have a look at the summary, you know exactly what it refers to. I hope that's helpful to everyone here. Is everyone on board, on track? Okay. Please take out the act. The act itself. Is that, we're dealing with the act, I understand, I hope, Ms. Hurling. Doc 1. And under document 1 then, pages 3 to 10 of the summary are those issues from date of the 3rd of February. What document was the 3rd of February? 9. Yeah. The document of the 28th. And the document called proposal.
The 28th of January is 5.
Draft 28 is 5, and the proposal, DTI's written proposal for consideration, submitted 15 Feb. 7. The second response is documents. 10 is 6. All right. So you've got out with you the 1, you're looking at 1, you're looking at 5, you're looking at 6, 7, and 9. Does everyone have those documents in front then? 1, 5. Let me see what my 5 is for that matter. 1, 3. There's my 5. 9. I got my 7. Yeah, and where is the 6? Is this 6? What's the 0?
But I have a copy of the interview, use my copy as we go along.
Oh, I like this. I mean, where is my 6? 3? Okay. So we all got the documents then. So now we're going to be looking at the summary then. This is document 9, for those who want to make refer to it. Definition of financial statement, section 1 of the Act, page 24, line 51. Now all we're doing here, you're going to tell me right now if you're happy and you can move straight ahead on the matter. No delay. If you want to make a comment, the comment is very quick. So here we are then, as we go through clause 1 and it refers to, gives us the definition of financial statement, page 24. Here it says line 51. I suppose the operative thing is line 51. And that financial statement, we move. As I don't see a hand or whatever, we move. The definition of juristic person, section 1 of the Act, 26, page 26, line 30. I know I'm giving you enough time because I'm going slow myself. See National Treasury proposal under clause 80 on page 42 of summary definition. Regulatory authority, section 1 of the Act. Page 30, line 43.
There's a column on document 19 which says committee's decision. So now, what decision have we taken then on the definition of a financial statement? Because we referred to 3 separate documents there. So what is our decision? See what I'm saying?
Yeah, this is why I just had an engagement with the people concerned, and I said, is everything here? We've covered some of these. No, we haven't. So, what is the issue, Ms. Hurling, then?
In terms of the column, it will be what the committee decides, so we're waiting your decision at this stage. The issues are obviously raised on the left-hand side, then, which the committee has to consider.
But the issue of financial statements itself, we've had coming up before. Mm-hmm. That's the point, I think, that you're trying to make, is it, Honourable Van der Merwe?
I mean, we've got the proposal from the DTI. Mm-hmm. We've got the summary of issues. Well, I don't think that's relevant because that's just a summary. So are we then accepting the proposal from the DTI in document 7? Is that what we do?
That's what we do. If we have
then we need to just bring you to come get into it. That's why we've got the, I've just given you the documents in the back.
Honourable members, here and there we spend time on some of the issues, and you'll see them coming up. Issues such as this whole insolvency, etc., we've had 3 meetings on, and we're not, as I said, right now, as we go clause by clause, we're not going to delay. Honourable Smiley?
Those words is not appearing in on document 7. So just to get it right, you know, we just need to, for our decision, our final approval, our committee decision, we've got to refer to the correct document so that it's been captured correctly.
Chair, what is it? If you read document 19 or document 7, which is our response, in the document 7, if we have not dealt with any issues raised as per document 19, it means that we don't accept those proposals. We've only dealt with document 7 with what we agree with in terms of an amendment. So if we don't have it in document 7, it means we don't agree with what has been said in the comments. Yeah, in the save as is.
We're just waiting for Margot to capture it, but we're going, the point I'm making is we are obliged to go through systematically now and not just dotting around in the act. We're going through systematically the issue so nothing falls through. Well, 5 as well. Let's go, we on number 1 with the Act, number 9, number 5, number 6, number 7. Those are the documents you should have in front of you. Right. Can we go back to 1? I'm saying from myself, I've ticked that one off. I didn't see an issue. But it was just at that point, I'm not sure if anyone had an issue with juristic persons that we, that is, Margot, Ms. Herling, do you want us to use this document here, or did you want us to follow, because I certainly can't see the screen, amendments outside the bill listed here? Because to me, I thought if we simply proceeded on the issues you'd highlighted, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Like section 15.2, Roman 2. The amendments outside of the bill. The problem with having her down
there. A few of the issues have not been addressed in the document 18, as Kathy hasn't given an opinion in terms of, because of the more counting issues. But everything else would then be from document 18. So again, the first few issues are more counting. So once we get to section 15, it will be from where Kathy has the raising issues.
So where do we use document
19? After section 15, which is clause 10 on document 19.
At this point here now, we're going to simply deal with your amendments outside the bill, and that means if we start with 15.2, that's the point I'm making. This document is called 18.
start to proceed.
So we would need to initially address the definitions as we have, and then I believe we have discussed section 2. The committee has just not ruled finally on what the decision was, and then clause 2, we just need to give our final opinion, and then from there on we'll deal with document 18.
Then we go back to juristic person, the definition. Nothing came up here that I noted that the committee had a problem with. Not at all. So we move. Yes.
So we are going to move through this document at this pace, because I note that what we left with is just capturing, but we have already completed the act vis-a-vis the proposed amendment. Is it not that the secretariat should write these, and then in our next meeting, then we simply adopt? Because if it means going through at this pace, I think we are unnecessarily repeating an exercise.
The only problem is they don't have our response in every respect. That's the only problem. So we can't ask them to make up a response for us. That's why.
But as we were discussing, at all stages, you seek to get the conclusion of the committee. And that was done. Where it was not done, it was where we said we are, what is that term, you know?
Flagging.
We are flagging. But where we did not flag, it means we agreed.
These were those. Initially, we handed this out last Tuesday or Wednesday. I forget the first day we met last week. And when we handed them out, they were handed out in two sections. The amendment bill, right? And then they were handed out because somebody had asked from our side, we had requested very earnestly for Ms. Herling to take those issues that had not been addressed in the amendment bill that had been raised in the public hearings. You see? Because we held public hearings. And some of the issues were not all directly related to the amendment bill. That's the issue. Yeah.
If the House understands thoroughly what we are doing, but I still think there is something that we are not doing right, because when we went through amendments, we were also taking into consideration the inputs from the hearings. We did not ignore anything. We took into account the interpretations from the experts, our experts, a DTI a team, as well as what came from the hearings. So I think that we are now going into an unnecessary exercise.
We took this decision at the time to do this. Work was done. And now we're saying, in a way, possibly it may have been unnecessary for us to take this into account. I think that's the kind of difficulty. But rather than go down the street, I think really I have to simply make a ruling then as chair, and to say that we had these public hearings, some of these issues, as we went through, we said we would flag them. After the summary, we took them, we asked Ms. Herling to extract them for us, And we need to effectively apply our minds to them, because certain, in the public hearings, which are an essential part of the process here, they raise certain issues. We can disagree right at the beginning. The problem is that we did not go through the act per se, clause for clause, but the issue arose that when we decided to amend the act, as you know, which we did outside of the amendment bill, and we did take that decision, DTI then also pursued certain amendments or proposals for amendments that they hadn't made in the amendment bill. We then opened the door to ensure that consideration would be made from the public hearings, anyone who had raised an issue in the Act, because we ourselves opened that door. And I think, you know, we did it because we felt we would get certainly a better amendment bill before us and have better legislation. And I think the changes that have been made have been very constructive. So I'm saying to complete that process, we need to ensure that we don't fall outside of the procedure that we are required to pursue. And that is why we put down these 2 days, so that we knew we'd have that time. So unfortunately, I know that it would seem to be a lot of extra work. It isn't that difficult or extra. We should remind ourselves that when we were over in Mark's building, we found the first half an hour very difficult, and after that we went very quickly and were doing 50-40 clauses at a time. We had no problem. So I think it's just ensuring that we are able to try and get through the process here before us. And I'm really appealing to committee members, those who can stay the journey with us to continue. I do know that there were certain apologies made to leave just some people for 5 or 10 minutes to attend to certain things, and other people to leave at 12:30, course to 1. So I'd like to start and proceed, please. So can we go back to the document we're going to go through? And that document is very quickly, I'll ask you to keep document 1 in front of you there. And I think we've already dealt basically with that. I don't know if Ms. Hurling has noted any points there. We then have page 55, etc. It says not applicable under that point there. Is that correct, Ms. Hurling? And then you've got clause 2. Is that right? A summary of the second response. And I've already said that that particular one is document 6. From DTI. And the document 6 from DTI, page 3, we can simply just agree. We have not, you see, agreed on that, all of those details there. We've been through that there, financial, juristic, the rest. Where assets equal liabilities. Yes, Molly, Honourable.
Sorry, Chairman. I was just reading. Chair, I was just going through some of our minutes of the 16th of February at the Marks Building, and it was something that my colleague Honourable Harris raised about the definitions about technical insolvency and clarifying. And bringing that into perspective, and we did agree as a committee on that. I just would like to make sure that it does appear somewhere, because I'm just trying to understand where the clarity of the definition is, because if it is taken on board, I do apologize, but if I can just know it's been done, then obviously I don't have to take the committee back on a later stage. Thank you.
If I recall, that was addressed both by our consultants as well as DTI at the time. We move to all of these here. This was agreed to in committee. So I suppose you simply want a formal response from us. Agreed. That's all I need from you. I can jog your memories as you go along. But we can't agree to it in bits and pieces. We need to go clause by clause at the end. So we've agreed. Right. Clause 10. Clause 10 is the summary. Right. The second response again. There's no 10. On the 10 over here, that one there in the memorandum, that was covered and dealt with as well. So we have no problem there. That was that memorandum of intent, was it, incorporation. The only thing is that rewording, I'm just checking to see on that other document we have from other consultants whether that's been addressed there as well. Mm-hmm. Yes, it has been. Right, agreed. You know, when I hear the word disagreed, I'm going to stop. All right, we're just going to move. Then we get to the next issue is 13. Too direct. Thirteen, no problem there. We had something here. Let me just see that. 12. I think this is 13 here. Is it the... Right. That was that whole thing on the reckless trading. We've long passed that. That was agreed to. We're now going, I'm going very quickly through here. The next one we're looking at is the insolvency one. We accepted the proposals put forward. Yes?
Forgive me, Madam Chair, you move faster than I can flip the pages. The on 20 sub 2, the 13th.
We've already dealt with that, though.
Yeah. Yes, and I've made some comments expressing some concern when we dealt with it.
Well, it may have been that we raised something, but we just agreed as a group.
But I don't want to redo it, but basically the notion is that the articles of incorporation are a public faith, public constructive knowledge document, and if the memorandum of incorporation says you cannot have the power to buy a house, and the company buys a house with directors, you can't have a special majority shareholders ratifying what the company cannot do.
You know, we addressed this extensively at the time, so I'll just ask our consultant to comment.
The rules as they stand at the moment in terms of our law is that at common law, shareholders have always had the ability to ratify ultra vires actions, to absolve directors from liability for them, but the status of the ultra vires transaction in relation to the company and third parties is that it is a valid transaction. But the ratification issue, I don't think should be adjusted in any way. So I don't think we should limit the ability of shareholders to ratify ultra vires actions.
Now, the point is, we have the debate. Say, if we're going to stand back because we have one dissenting voice, I don't see on we will never get a bill through at any time. So we do have to allow some engagement,
yeah,
but not
enough.
According to that.
Very nice.
Very nice. So if we can just get myself back on track after that.
17. No, 22. Now I'm looking at 17.
That one,
there,
is taking it out.
Yeah, no, I don't like it. I have my hood. She hasn't hit 22 yet.
Yes, but it's not, NA is not applicable to say because
NA simply means that there isn't a clause in the bill at the moment. Even so, in certain instances, we've got a clause in the column, a number. It means that the section we're addressing, there isn't a specific sub clause under the clause in the amendment. If that makes sense.
We're looking at the Act. Comments were made in the public hearing. Comments. What staff are trying to do is link the comments to the Act. You know, hang them somewhere. Some of them didn't hang. Okay? So they are lying here. I mean, you can't say it is clause X or clause Y. Isn't that correct?
So, nevertheless, if we look at the summary there, I'm saying the issue of reckless trading and insolvency was dealt with at length by this committee in the broadest of parameters. And as such, we went forward with a particular clause. This is what I'm saying. There were actually proposals from DTI, there were proposals even from the consultants and this.
Sorry, Chair, if you could indulge me. I feel quite strongly about this particular section of the Act. I'm not happy with the proposed rewording as on the screen at the moment. I thought the committee had decided that these provisions were to hit companies that carried on trading recklessly or fraudulently or whilst they were commercially insolvent in that they were unable to pay their debts, but not to hit companies that are merely technically insolvent in the sense that they're liabilities exceed their assets. If that understanding is correct, I don't think the proposed amendment on screen addresses it or fixes the problem at all. I have suggested my own rewording. If I could refer you to document 13 on page 7 and following. Page 7 of document 13 is how I would like the rewording to look, if my understanding of the committee's decision is correct.
Remind me, look, we took a decision, we took our wording at the end of the last meeting to our consultants and said, does this capture the intention, with our intention? The consultants are saying, it doesn't quite capture your intention. So it's doing her job as we word it. We've already taken the decision, but we didn't word it very well. We would proceed with that.
So I think really what the committee needs to decide is whether my proposed rewording is an improvement and a better reflection of your substantive intent than the suggested wording that is recorded on document 19.
And that's really, it's about the wording. You know, we asked our consultants, and we said, Honourable Edwards, in the Honourable Smiley.
Madam Chair, we had a long discussion, yes, I was involved in it, on this aspect. But I did not understand during this discussion that finality was reached, and you indicated that it would be flagged. So it seems, however, here the flag has fallen, because the point that I was making, rightly or wrongly, and I'm sure I carry back this influence and the consultant, but I feel strongly about this as well, is that the entire notion of reckless trading and gross negligent trading should go out, just leaving the intent to defraud creditors. If there is, and the entire notion of insolvency should go out. The greatest companies in the world, from Bill Gates, from Warren Buffett, to Steve Jobs, anyone I can think about, they were reckless, they were grossly negligent to their shareholders, and they created that out of debt, the spring of ingenuity, which enables those companies to succeed. I could speak to you for hours about all those examples, and if you wish, I will document them. There is no need, from a regulatory legislative viewpoint, for us as legislators to be concerned of anything but defrauding the creditors. If somebody is wasting the money of the shareholders, we don't need to be the nanny state. It's their problem. If somebody is reckless, they're wasting their money. So I would like, unless at this point the committee decide to close the issue, for this proposal to be carried forward into the next deliberative stage, unless that's the end of it.
Deliberating further on it. Yes, Honourable Mabasa. Honourable Smiley.
If there is a clause that has been debated, so we are not going to derive anything new out of discussing it further, because Member Ambrosini spoke at length on this issue, and the meeting took a view that we cannot, as lawmakers, have a law that allows reckless trading. You know the negatives. We must aim for the optimum. So for that reason, I will think we should not accept the argument of Member Ambrosini. And I must repeat, he has placed the argument on the table. We have looked at it.
Honourable Smiley, and then Honourable Member Merva. Honourable Member Merva. Sorry. No, I just thought I was skipped. I would like to propose the wording of Cathy Adamson as she put forward as amended to our specifications officially, and you know, the only word that that could be put out of context, it depends on how you want to debate it, is the actual word reckless. You know, that's the actual, you need then just to define that specific word, but that's the only word that could in this whole context actually put it in a negative or a positive way, and depending on how you want to debate the whole actual issue. But for the point of moving forward, yes, ma'am.
I basically want to. We have two differing versions in front of us, and I thought that we should. I would like to hear the DTI's arguments against Ms. Adamson. Proposal, if they have such an argument, and I also want to get clarity on the dashed points at the bottom of the document 19, page 3, where it says make DTI's indirect definition more direct. When is this happening? Insert definition of trading under insolvent circumstances, and so on. And what is the status of those bullet points?
Let's take it in that order then. DTI.
Thank you, Chair. The DTI has got a bit of a problem with creating a prohibition in an act where you
where the Act says a company must not carry on business or trade in circumstances in which it is unable to satisfy the liquidity test. The problem with creating a prohibition without a concomitant or a sanction that runs along with it is that you say something must be done, but you don't say what will happen if you don't do it. So there's no penalty that will fall on this contravention. That is the reason, and because trading under insolvent circumstances is not really a crime or shouldn't be made a statutory offence, that was the reason why the DTI opted to go for the warning signal provision, as we have it in the proposed subsection 2, where if a company is trading in circumstances where it's actually insolvent, then the commission will have the power to investigate and to write a note, send a notice to this company to point out why it should be allowed to carry on business and why it shouldn't be placed into liquidation or in business rescue, whatever the case might be in the circumstances. And for that simple reason that we do not have a sanction, we prefer to go the way of creating a red flickering light which will empower, which will, and then empower the commission to take certain steps in that that case.
Thank you very much. Ms. Ivinson?
I could just respond to the issues in the sequence in which they were raised. The first concern was, should we define the term reckless trading? The answer is there's no need for that. We have countless decided cases from our courts explaining to us exactly what reckless trading means. There is an established, well-recognized legal definition. It basically means trading in circumstances where a reasonable person would have realized or should have realized that the company was verging on insolvency and would become unable to pay its debts. So I don't think we need to define reckless. Insofar as the DTI's issues are concerned, I don't think the absence of a sanction is important. Subsection 1 of Section 22 relates directly and only to Subsection 2, which is what the Commission can do in relation to companies that are acting in ways which are considered unduly risky for their creditors. Trading under insolvent circumstances, I don't know what that means. That isn't defined. But there are certainly, as many stakeholders have indicated, literally thousands of companies that are technically insolvent. Do we really want them to all be targeted by the Commission and then bear the fairly onerous burden of having to satisfy the Commission within a short period of time that they can continue trading? Because as soon as you put companies in those kinds of tight situations where they are forced to justify their existence, you are jeopardizing the status of all sorts of third parties, shareholders, creditors, and so on.
You see why we had these discussions on them, and I assure you when bills become active, the discussions continue ad nauseum on the clauses, etc. So there has to come a time when you say, we have addressed the issue. We did not reach consensus on it. But have we actually applied our minds to issues? I'm looking here, and I've written people's names against that. This is the document I was looking for. Advocate Stratum is written here. Harris. Remedy here put under someone here. Is no Ambrosini's name around on that one, and that was the very first time this issue was dealt with. You then raise this afterwards, and then unfortunately you missed other meetings, but we dealt with this extensively. The only point that we had a problem with in the end is we put something down and we weren't sure whether that wording would, you know, pass the test, etc. So as with everything we've done, we've taken it through our own consultants and say, what is your opinion here? So having said that, what you can do, Honourable Ambrosini, is when you come to the consideration, which will be when? On the 9th. That is the day that you can raise your objection. but we're not going to spend more time
allow
deliberating.
Allow me just a second, if you would.
Honorable Anderson.
There was another issue which I understood DTI having agreed on and understood, and they were going to redraft it. Because one concedes that there is no sanction to the violation of the mask. There is no criminal sanction. But whenever you violate a mask, there are always sanctions. The conduct in violation of law is illegal, is wrongful. Whether that causes damages, whether it exposes to liability, whether it creates a delict, there is always in the legal system a sanction to the violation. So my understanding is that if you were going to collapse 1 and 2 in recognition of what I said and making the
Honorable Ambrosini, you're going over the same territory.
It's a different territory, Madam Chair.
Not exactly.
It becomes.
Now, I'm going to stop you there. No, I'm not giving you an opportunity to speak at the moment.
Well, it's quite unfair, Madam Chair, because it's a legitimate point. It was raised.
No.
And it was discussed.
What you can do is really just follow the proceedings and raise this again. And you'll have that opportunity under consideration. So I'm now going to ask the committee here. We have a proposal from someone, proposes an acceptance of what was put there. We then had Honorable Van der Merwe, I think, asking, well, a particular view, was it, Honorable Van der Merwe from DTI. We don't have a seconder yet for that position forward as a committee. So either we need another proposal to go on with, or we flag it. So what are we going to do, Honorable Kwabasa?
No, Chairperson, I thought there was a proposal which said that the committee adopts the phrasing as put forward by Ms. Aitkinson. And yes, Chair, I want to second it because it captures also to an extent what we had written on document 19 that we are referring to. But it's written in a much more appropriate manner. Let's adopt it as is.
Thank you very much. We move forward. All right. 17. We look at that. We didn't have a problem there. There was an agreement. Where we saw an agreement, we had no problem. Do you recall that, Ms. Hurling? Fine. So we agreed. 18. Consider changing the period for changes in the financial year to take no later than 18 months. But we, in fact, have already taken another position on that. I hope you've got that, Ms. Hurling. As already put forward. You need to say something now because we're moving. Right, Ms. Hurling? We're moving on it. Accepted. We're not accepting, you know, what we did do is if you look at your own notes here, summary page 6 second, what is it, the second response that we have here, then I think is that document 5 or 6? Just a minute. That's document 5 or 6. 5. Okay. Right. Yes, Honorable Smiley?
If I could recall, I think the committee agreed on a period of 15 months, 1-5. Just to put that forward.
Not what we've written here, but has someone got that written down? Because that's not what I've got here. So please, allow me to speak at the moment. So if we put that forward, we said we agreed. That's the point I said earlier. We agreed. We did not agree with what is here, but we agreed with the earlier.
postpone that to change the
issue. We're not going along with the comments here that you've got here. It's a written problem. We've looked at this and we haven't agreed with it. We're moving with the earlier one, which is captured in document 5 and 6, 18, rules 18. Financial reporting standards, etc. Again, that was the DCR put forward a proposal there, and we also agreed with that. We recommend that amendment be made to limit the IFR standards to public companies only. We agreed with that. Then we come in. Now, this is, we're not agreeing with what the statement is saying here. We're agreeing with our earlier submission. Okay. Deliberated upon, and on my own notes here, I don't want to say I have a note as such, I haven't, but it was something that did go across to Ms. Idenson. If with respect to a particular company, every person who is a holder of or who has a beneficial interest in any securities, that company is also a director of that company is exempt from the requirements in this section to have its annual financial statements, etc. I'm sure all of you have got that document. It does not apply to the company if it falls into a class, etc. But it's not dealing with future directors, you see, at this particular point on here. And it was raised by a committee member. DTI, do you recall what you indicated in that regard? It was more clarification. How could a future director get involved?
Yes, Chair. Now, the question of future directors, a future director should only be, only known future directors could in any way be included in this requirement, the particulars of them be provided or their remuneration. Where there's already an agreement for an appointment of a future date or something, you've also got to include them.
So you can't delete future directors on that basis. I know we agreed with them on the point, but somebody raised that. That NA means it was not in the Act. Page 20 there of the summary. Proposal amendment to clause 16C has made contravention of 1631 an offence. So, if I look under summary C, under the summary, we'll get that particular one up. It is not in the Act itself. I'm just concerned about some people who have made an early apology as well. 16, do we see that there is an offence on the right, recommendation from stakeholders. We looked at that, I know. The committee is requested to replace the word and ors, etc., but we dealt with that. It's gone, accepted. All right? We dealt with that, Ms. Hurling. We dealt with that. It's already been addressed earlier by DTI in its proposal. All right? 28. A
that particular one was involved with asset stripping. Do we remember that issue, asset stripping, which came up on several occasions? Again, we spent a lot of time on asset stripping. The DTI disagrees, etc. It was crafted as it is to prevent asset stripping from one company, etc. And we got lengthy explanations from DTI on the matter. And if I recall, I don't think our... it didn't disagree with it as such. Ivinson is in agreement with DTI. So, right, we really don't have a problem there at all. So we go on to the next one, which again we need to go to the summary, page 62-63, to see what it was. Right. Clarify whether the redemption of preference shares, which constitutes a distribution, also constitutes an acquisition, according to section 48. And that was, and I just looked here. But if you look at the issue itself, DTI did address it, and so, and we accepted that. I look here at what our consultant would have said on it as well. And, what number was that?
Document 18.
And the consultant, her view here, 20.
Cheers, and document 18, my view is summarized.
Document 18. I'm just looking at 13 where we looked at some of the final issues. Agreed, you see. It's agreed. So the changes there that we looked for, because that was the last time we sent documents to you, which we had outstanding responses to and had to respond. We then come to 41, Clause 41, Section 63, summary, page 5, second response. Clarify the remuneration of directors applies to only non-executive or also to executive directors. In that particular one there, if we go to this here. Not really addressed there per se. It's only when I see it that I can. 63. It's page 5 of the second response. Where's the second response? Okay, it's not that form, I put. There we are. Okay. These numbers you couldn't see. It's a disagreement anyway by DTI in that particular area, from what I can gather. Is that correct? I can't see the numbering this well. This is one where the numbers didn't come out that well. So what does it say up there? It's 41. Certainly there's no comment here per se then. So do you have any comment now to please proposal DTI?
Well, Chair, we prefer it to that it should remain as it is. The Act doesn't draw any distinction between an executive and a non-executive director. They are all directors and they must be treated equally.
Agreed. Right, let's move. That was 41. And then we go to, right, 44. Defer implementation. No, well, we've already just taken that decision. Gone, passed, agreed. page 64 summary amend section to address the situation where minutes are being disputed. I certainly don't recall addressing an issue of minutes being disputed. Page 64 of the summary. These are issues which are not in the amendments, which don't rise anywhere per se, but which are commented on. So people say, what do you do when minutes are disputed? Was that Barsa? Yes, it is Barsa. They are wanting, what they would have liked to have seen is any minutes of a meeting or a resolution signed by the chair of the meeting or by the chair of the next meeting of the board shall constitute, unless the contrary is proved, valid evidence. So, where do we want to take this, DTI? Do you have any proposal to make there? It's just simply to do with the minutes that are disputed.
Yeah, no, I think it's an internal matter that the company could easily regulate those matters in its MOI or within internal rules.
To address the situation, and we've just done that, 45. And that becomes apply the same amendment, etc. Definition. Ivanson has given us an opinion in that area. Let's just see what we've got there. Let's see what we have there. All right, that opinion must have come out just before this on what documents it would have been. Just check. Ms. Herling, what document was that one in? Because we've had several opinions now. We can't get beyond that unless we have it. What opinion was that?
It's document 11.
Document
11.
Pardon? Document 11.
Which one was it? 45.
That's 46. That's 45. All right, we won't delay ourselves there until someone can find it.
Perhaps if I could just clarify, various stakeholders had indicated they were unhappy with the fact that there are different sections of the Act which define the term directed differently for their own purposes. And the stakeholder's suggestion was that there should be a single uniform definition of a directive that should be used for the purposes of all for all the sections concerned. And the sections in question are sections 69, 76, 77 and 78. And I was basically in agreement with the stakeholder suggestions that the term director be defined consistently throughout those sections, except for section 78, which needs to keep a special reference to past directors. So I was basically agreeing with the stakeholder submissions there.
Right. We have something here which does affect us now. Does DTI wish to make any proposals in this regard?
Chair, the only comment that we would like to make is that we think that it's appropriate for the differentiation of the definition for the specific purposes as these sections 69, but also including 75, which deals with disclosure of financial interest by directors, and 77 and 78, where the for those sections, the definition is broadened. And for the rest of the Act, you've got a narrow down, more generic one.
Right. Because what we've got here on document 18, for those who just have that then, section 78, which must keep the reference to past directors, I'm just looking at our document 18, section 73.8, agree with submission, minutes shall be rebutted, presumably to be, shall be rebuttable, etc. So, really what you're saying is that one section you have a narrower definition and you are, DTI would like to retain that, and in another section it's broader. What our own consultant is putting forward here, I can't actually read, so she will merely, I think, speak to it because I can't read that.
I'm simply suggesting that we use the same concept and definition of a director for all of those sections except for the section 78 quirk in relation to past directors.
It's not quite in line with the proposal we had from yourselves, was it, DTI? So we may wish, just as a committee, to look at what our consultant has on hand. Would there be any special reason why you would have a problem if it was changed?
Jamie, would have a problem with that. Writing the definition as per those sections, and when you find the word director in other sections, it means it's going to take on that wider meaning which we don't want. It's going to have a consequential problem with other parts of directorships and the mentioning of directors being used. Yeah, for let me give you an example, Jay. In 66, it talks about the board of a company must comprise, for example, in a private company, at least one director. When we define directors in the other sections, we also define them as, for example, prescribed officers, as being forming part of the definition of director. We can't have a prescribed officer then being forming part of the incorporation of a private company because he's called by something else.
Now, I certainly hear what you're saying. We'll certainly look at it as a committee, all right? I don't want us to delay now. So we'll simply, we've only now, I hope you understand, got one issue flagged. One. That one. Nothing else. We then move to the next one down at the bottom, a full audit, the bottom of page 6 there, a full audit would be required for an auditor to give his or her assurance that a company that is voluntarily winding up has no debts, and that was at page 64 area, of the summary, page 6 of the second response. If I look at the second response here, page 6. The requirement, is that the one where it goes there? Is that the new section, Ms. Hurling? Ms. Hurling, is that new section there on the Department of Trade and Industry? Because we... In the copy we've got, it's chopped off a little bit. Requirement for an auditor to determine that a company has no debt. It's not that one. Page 6. Page 64 of the summary and page 6 of the second response. No. Where exactly is that, Ms. Hurling, if you can draw our attention to it, because we can't see the left-hand side of this page. Just read it then from your screen.
Can you clarify what exactly I need to read?
We're on this at the bottom of the page 6, document 19. A full audit would be required for an auditor to give his or her assurance.
It's section 80, section 3B2. It's on page 156, line 52. Line 52 of the Act.
The mic.
It's on page 156, line 52 of the Act.
156. Right, no, we didn't raise any issues here and have any issues, that's the point. So it's an issue that came up then. I remember at the time issues came up about the auditing of books from these small businesses, etc. That was an issue we did deliberate on, as to whether all of them should have these audits. Now I'm just at this stage working out whether or not that is what you are referring to when you say here that section there, which we can't, you know, which we actually didn't even deal with. I know you said it came from public hearings. Page 64, which who raised this in public hearings? The appointment of an auditor, is that it there? Is it Psyker here? Is that the one? In the case of private companies, auditors often performing, etc., etc., the restrictions in section 92B would immediately disqualify many auditors from being appointed to perform voluntary audits of private companies. The Act should include a provision that only section 92B1 should apply as a disqualification for the appointment of an auditor where a company opts to be audited voluntarily. Is that the one you're referring to?
No.
Or are you referring to the voluntary winding up of a solvent company? And that is section 83B2. That one was put forward by, it would seem to be only PwC at the time. And we certainly didn't deliberate on it at length. We did deliberate about auditors in general and the work they can and can't do, and when it was an absolute requirement. So, members, on that particular one, have you got any opinion here? DGI, do you want to make any comments there?
Chair, maybe I could just comment. Section 80 requires when a resolution for the voluntary winding up of a solvent company is filed and registered that the company must also obtain a certificate from the company's auditor that to the best of the auditor's knowledge and belief and, and according to the financial records of the company, the company appears to have no debts. So it's a solvent company. What the master wants in this case is just some indication or confirmation that there are no debts. So it's for instance, a company that's a cash shell who wants to liquidate and distribute the money to its members. There's no debt. And now the Pricewaterhouse now says that this certificate would require an audit. And it's merely an opinion that is required in this case, and I really can't see that it can go as far as an audit, that they have to perform an audit to give an opinion. The company doesn't have debt.
Thank you very much. It's Honourable Ambrosini, followed by Honourable Smalley.
Just following up on what has been said, a point of clarification. How can an auditor determine that the company is not debt?
The financial statement.
But going through two things: general ledger or the actual books and transactions of the company. I mean, the financial statement is the product of an auditor. Otherwise, the company can just submit its own financial statement to the master. If one requires, and with which I would be very, very happy, because I think this requirement is excessive, but I don't see how any auditor or any accountant could state on record for the benefit of third parties that the company is not debt, if all it needs to do is read the financial statement and cannot go beyond it, of course it will want to do an audit. And it will have to do an auditing of the company, which is going to be very expensive.
Jay, I want to agree to say that without an audit, you will not be able to determine if there are any creditors left. So an audit has got to be done, a financial audit, in order for the master to make a ruling. And auditors are supposed to be reputable firms that will be used and goes with some sort of a credibility linked to their firms and persons and individuals. And I want to say that an audit is required in that case.
So there's a view on the table that in this particular case there should be an auditor should be involved, just for everyone, just to ensure where we are working from. We're working right at the top there, aren't we? Page 64 of the summary on the left there, you'll see is that it was labeled in A. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And in the main act. Now, this has not come up on this particular case, but it's come up, the auditing, in a number of other cases. And I know that the kind of decision we were taking was that we needed to broaden the scope of those who could audit. We're not audit books, but give opinions. Is that... it depended on the work that they were doing. But certainly, it wasn't only going to be restricted to auditors' certain activities that had to be done. So I know that there was something there. The other thing was the inclusion of advocates and auditors and certain things. But this particular one, other than being in the public hearings, we've never really dealt with. I don't know if... DTI ever looked at it again after going to the public hearings, and if Ms. Ivinson, it hasn't come up before in anything that I'm aware of, if that has come up at all, and whether you have an opinion on it at all.
I'm not an accountant, but it seems to me that the DTI's position is a credible and sensible one.
Honourable Ambrosini, that you had commented last time, that's why I'm just looking at it here. An auditor precluded from the normal functions of the company. Role has changed with new act requirements, etc. This is something that you put in during that deliberation.
It was a SAICA submission, which has not been captured correctly. The issue here was why shouldn't an auditor also be a secretary?
Well, you're going to have to talk a lot louder.
Well, okay. The issue was why shouldn't the auditor be able to perform also as the secretary of the company, which very often they do. The response from the DTI is that they need to be completely independent, that they should have nothing to do with the company, and that's the only way that we can ensure the impartiality in looking at the company. the consideration is that this is increases the cost of doing business. The running of companies in this country is very expensive as it is. This would be a way of reducing the cost of this business, cost of doing business, because all these people, company secretaries, auditors, I mean, it sounds bad, but they exercise a parasitic function. They're not part of the production. This is their management compliance.
Yeah.
So it's a cost of administering the company. And this was a small way of reducing those costs if the auditors could also be secretaries. And it was not my suggestion, it was from Saika.
I know that the little deliberation we had in this area here, the point was being made that the auditor should be independent. Now, that, when it did come up, I don't recall offhand if Ms. Idenson made any comments there.
I addressed this issue when it was raised in debate. I addressed it orally at an earlier meeting, but I'm in agreement with the DTI that there does need to be complete independence on the part of the auditor.
So I think here, I mean, I'm looking at what DTI says here. The DTI disagreed with the earlier comments there and then stated the auditor must be an independent person. So there's no disagreement. I mean, the committee's of that view. So we go to 53, resignation of auditors and vacancies. Well, actually, that's not 53. It's NA. My apologies to you in coming back to document 19. The term designated auditor should be defined. Really, do we need the term designated auditor to be defined? We know what an auditor is. We know what someone designated is. Right. Does anyone have a serious problem with that? No. 54 is add a reference to the ability of the board to elect to appoint an audit committee in accordance with this section, including the audit committee's report in the annual report rather than in the annual financial statements. That is certain comments coming out of public hearings. If we look at 54 here, yeah, we have comments here about the audit committee anyway. IOD, KPMG, DTI agrees it is recommended that the drafting, is this right, that the drafting be improved to clearly higher-aligned oversight functions, but that was in particular to do with 54 and perhaps another section, and that was 94 itself, and this is 94. So we've addressed that. We got a proposal forward, so we agree. We move on. We move on now to page 8. We've already dealt with that oversight issue. Yes, Ms. Herling?
Chair, I just want to draw your attention.
You're going to talk a lot louder.
Ms. Idenson has raised a concern.
I can't hear you at all. Now here's the other one.
Chair, on document 15,
yeah.
Page 15, there's also another wording issue that may be of concern.
Document 13, page 15. Thank you. Document 13, page 15, right? If we look at that clause 54 at the top of the page, what we best do here, we've got Ms. Idenson with us, so that she, as it were, reads to her document, as it were, as if before us here, the opinion, where the current wording of the amendment suggests that there is an obligation on the board to delegate other functions to the audit committee. Surely the board should be able to delegate further matters to the committee if necessary, but should not be under any obligation to do so, especially since the kinds of other matters contemplated are no longer specific. If so, I suggest the following rewording. I, to perform such other functions as may be determined by the board. Is that correct there? Fine. So that is the proposal. Above that, you would have seen the clause. Do you see that there? And the references that are being made there. Under I, to perform other functions. Okay. Including, to have X and Y and Z, but that was excluded.
To amend subsection 7.1.
So it says, because over here it says to perform other functions determined by the board, okay? The suggestion is simply a very simple one, to perform such other functions as may be determined. Are you putting that because it's the first one is seen as obligatory and the other one as an option, and that there's no reason why it shouldn't be an option? All right, so DTI, that's what we would be going. What is your comment?
Gee, we have got no problem with the proposal. It's just the objection to the section as it was the question of executive versus oversight functions. And we might just add another word into that proposal as well, to perform such other oversight functions as may be determined by the board. Then it should take away all the objections that was initially against it.
That's a very good suggestion, because it dealt with oversight. So all we are looking to agree with here is to perform such other oversight functions. You see the gray? As may be determined by the board. That grey box there, okay, for all of us. So we just added that in and we move. And then we, you stopped me, I think, because it was just that one that was overlooked, was it, Ms. Hurling? And then we definitely are on founding documents and memorandum. Is that correct? On page 8. Change the words memorandum of incorporation to founding. Well, this was a suggestion put forward. The amendment on the committee's decision we have already noted here. In the case of a foreign company, a copy of its memorandum of incorporation or comparable governing document, etc., with a list of names. So that is our decision there anyway that we have noted. So we move again, can we? And we then move to 65. See page 65 of the summary. Someone in the public hearing said, excluding the passage of passing of mortgage bonds, etc., to do with security, etc. See page. All it is a summary. There be no other comments anywhere else. So just to refresh your memories there. Sections 112 and 115. What is L? Is that long-term issue, the LSSA, securities issue, Ms. Hurling? The LSSA.
It's the Law Society.
Pardon?
The Law Society.
The Law Society. And they are looking for excluding the passage on mortgage bonds, etc. I'm not too sure what they may know about mortgage bonds, but anyway. Although case law exists regarding the interpretation, well, you can read it there for yourselves. It has been put forward. The LSSA are therefore of the view that this uncertainty And the uncertainty they are referring to is case law exists regarding the interpretation of the word dispose in relation to 228 of Companies Act. But it is uncertain as to whether the courts will come to the same conclusion with regard to the interpretations of sections 112 and 115. So we've got that opinion. Remember, this all went to DTI. I'm sure you're aware of that. So they are very familiar with that. DTI, do you have any further comments to add here before we take our decision?
No, Chair. That's just the opinion that they have, that the mortgage bond could be regarded as selling your property. And I don't think it's not exactly what is happening in practice. So I think the courts will come to the correct decisions if it needs to be interpreted.
I'm sure you, judging from
your face, you share that. I agree with the DTI on this one.
Right. And then we go to page 977. Just so that other members would know, I will certainly alert you to Friday if necessary. But we're hoping to plow on. And good, you know, and certainly hope it will be very constructive, the workshop and conference you're going to, both of you. On that page 9 there, if we can turn to the summary page 6 of the second response, the definition of financially distressed. But we dealt with that, we passed it on, because it came up in other areas. Do you remember the distress issue? And the DTI came up with something, so we can pick that one. The point is, when we say tick, we got a position put forward on something else, Ms. Hurling. So if you want to just let us do the absolute reference, it's going to take us later.
We're on
77
then,
yeah? Here we are, 77, financially distressed.
77.
We can't hear that mic.
See, we've gone too far. We were 67 and 68 already.
We can't hear you, so you're going to use another mic.
Sorry, if I may, I think Ms. Hurling's saying you haven't addressed number 67. You've jumped ahead too far.
C5. We've done the memorandum of incorporation, all right? 65 is the mortgage bond. Done that. 67 should exclude a trust or foreign company, as these are unable to pass special resolutions as holding companies in South Africa. We did in fact deal with foreign companies, so let's see that in summary, page 13 response, and we see document 11, leave a clause, a certain clause 67G as is, and refer to finance legislation as one suggestion by Smalley. Did you see that Smalley there on that form? And what did we get from UDTI on the foreign stuff that came out? Document 11. Document 11 is an opinion. That is from Eisenstein there.
Sorry, if I may interject, I have not expressed an opinion on this question of whether section 1152B should exclude foreign companies or trusts. I haven't been asked to express an opinion on that.
I'm just looking. I don't think it was exactly that issue, because I'm looking at what is expressed here. It talks about, on page 4 of one of the opinions, in terms of section 1152, it's talking about resolutions being approved, etc., 15% of voting rights. But this particular one here is not directly related to the point Ms. Eisenson was asked to make or comment on. You know, was the other aspects of this. The opinion here that she gives is not the opinion directly related to this point of foreign companies here, you see. So this is a new thing that we're looking at. But it is foreign companies were commented on by DTI. Could you just refer to that, please? Ms. Eisenson made a comment there, but not on this issue. Right. Have you got that in front of you, DTI? With respect to the foreign area, foreign companies. It's specifically dealing with that issue of foreign companies. But you see, at the time, and when you referred to foreign companies, you actually said foreign companies would have to register here as well. Was that one of the clauses that you modified? Could you address that?
Yeah, I'm just
Yes, as far as the trust are concerned, the holding company is defined as including a trust. So the remark regarding trust is not going anywhere. The remark as far as foreign holding companies are concerned, yes, it can be the case. But in the interpretation of South African law, you cannot apply South African law to a foreign company. They're not automatically subject to our laws. So as far as it would relate to a foreign company, foreign holding company, of course, then the provision would not be enforceable against it as it stands currently.
So that point was made in another section and it holds here as well. Okay, so we really, Honourable Somali, I'm not sure if you still want to say anything further because I think that the rest of the committee would like to move on it. Right, fine, we move. 68, the Financial Services Board, mergers, etc., page 6 of the second response. Yes, Honourable Salah? Well, then, let's hear for the record and we can get it. So it's done, isn't it? We've agreed on that one, yeah.
Yes.
Thank you, Honourable Salah.
On 17,
No. Not that one.
Are we on 17?
7. We've done financially distressed.
Yeah.
Business rescue practitioner. We've already passed, this is all superseded. We've addressed all those issues. Our comments are captured elsewhere. 78. We've dealt with that whole issue of the business rescue, from its birth to its demise. Now, can we go to NA? Right, we've got one NA issue here. Allow that applications for objections to companies' resolution regarding the business rescue may also be made to the company's tribunal. The company's tribunal was raised in one of our discussions, but just to refresh our memories, please, DTI. Eisenson agrees with DTI, so I mean, I know we agree, but just refresh us quickly and just...
Chair, yes, it's simply that the proposal is that the tribunal be authorized to, upon application by an interested party, to set aside the resolution for the business rescue. And we just say it goes beyond this in the scope of the tribunal to perform that function, and it should remain an option that you can will have to go to court to set aside the business rescue resolution.
Thank you. Then we are moved on because our own consultant also was of the same opinion, agreed there. And we remove the failure to pay over any employment-related obligations or debts as grounds for the business. Again, we dealt with that. 80. Amend section 133. No, I'm just looking at that myself. This issue here, the summary, you'll see it there, page 14 of the response, and the proposals are there. The whole issue around VAT, UIF, etc. And we also have with us comment from our own, an opinion on document 13, page 16, I think, is it?
Yeah.
Clause 80. And there are one or two issues here. If you want to address them just verbally to talk, have you got the documents in front of you as well, Ms. Ivanson?
I do, yes, thank you. This is really about the position of regulators in the event of a company going into business rescue proceedings, whether they should be able to carry on their regulatory actions and proceedings against the company. And we decided that they should. All I have suggested on page 16 and 17 of document 13 is a slight rewording of somebody else's proposed rewording of the relevant section. It's section 133, isn't it?
Yes, no, we're in agreement with that. I mean, included it in the amendment.
In fact, DTI seem to be in agreement with the proposals, all the rewordings that are just now captured finally here. What is our opinion as a committee? Right, we go with our... Right, fine. We move on then. And we move on to 81. Require that if it doesn't agree with DTI, that it is the company's prerogative to initiate the proposal. The issue coming out of public hearing requires that the person with a security interest to be held liable for the cost of realizing of the property by deducting these, etc., etc. You can look it up there in the summary, which is on page 43 of summary, page 14 of response. Now, in this point here, I'm not sure, we've just got agreement there, if we can just, I don't know if it was just absolutely reflected here, but no, it means it was studied in the, one of the issues that we just referred and we don't have a problem with, so can we agree? 82. The success of the entire BR process, business rescue. All right, I don't know why this is in grey, though. Why would it be in grey?
82, amendment.
Unintentional, right, okay. Then the issue here is the post-commencement, due to the inherent risk associated with post-commencement finance, it is possible that the pricing of this finance could place it out of reach, especially SMMEs. I know we raised this at length and discussed this. Some of you will recall that. And so you go and you get this finance, and then time passes by, and very little collateral, etc. And it sometimes, the pricing of the, I suppose the interest, etc., we were just, I think a phrase that would be, we wouldn't want to undermine the small businesses that it was intending to help. But let's just look, the DTI, that the post-commencement finance is only in reference to non-payment of employees. So we agree, we move along. 83. Honourable Smiley?
Just for a point of clarity on 83, it will read as per document 16 that was handed out this morning. We asked for a rewording yesterday after the debate, and I just would like to confirm if we agree.
Document 16.
Document 16.
Yeah, that one has, it looks like this. It doesn't have the University of Cape Town's badge there, but there we are, okay? If you look at that one there, and clause 83 of the bill, I would recommend that section 136 in its D36 in its final form be reworded along the following lines. Effect of business rescue on employees' contracts. Have you had the opportunity of reading this, members? So, do you have a comment then, Honourable Smiley?
No, I agree with the rewording as per document 16, and just would like to make sure that that is what the committee agrees on.
Coming from our consultant here, a suggested wording for that section. Can we all just apply our minds? It is an area that was raised. And we did ask, after our discussions were captured, we asked Ms. Idenson to word it for us. So from what we said, she has put this wording in. But those of you who haven't read it, just scan it, please. There. All right. So we are all in agreement. Can we move on this, Ms. Hurling? Okay, that was 83. And then we have another one, not the act, yes. See page 15 of proposal. And the proposal again was this, this one here, the 15th of February. Add requirement that relevant regulatory authorities must be notified by a practitioner. Yes, we just dealt with this recently. Do you remember? Yes, agreed. I mean, didn't we agree there? Fine, next one. See page 68, 69 of summary, page 15, response X. The business rescue. My word, we could write a book on just this business rescue in its own right. Whether voidable transactions should be referred to management or not. Voidable. We have had at length issues there and discussions. Honourable Salah, Quabasa, Elvis, mainly, you know, I'm starting from the bottom up, mainly to allow for dual processes. Then we have Honourable Quabasa, maybe the May to. Or must, rather, possibly change and may to or must. And earlier, Honourable Salah saying possibly change and to or. So everyone, you remember it was that kind of last issue we tackled there. Do you recall that? And we were all just making our little contributions at that point. So where are we now with this thing? Where should we take this? I think what you need to do is to go to, it's section 141, okay, hang on, am I right? Yes. 2C, page 246, line 50. Voidable. Okay, here we have voidable coming. Now, then let's look up DTI, anything that may have come. summary response, page 15 of proposal. Do you want to talk to a VTI?
Yes, thank you. I think the proposal that we made, that the practitioner must take the necessary steps and that he may also use management in the process, would be the correct approach. The responsibility should rest with the practitioner to determine what steps need to be taken. He can take them himself or he can instruct management then to take the necessary steps that he thinks should be taken.
You see, if you recall, honourable members, these were new clauses, do you remember? In document 7, do you remember that? And then we also had our consultant, so if you take the document 7, page 15, and then if you also take our own consultant, document 13, page 18, then you're kind of looking at all the relevant ones. And of course the comments we made so that we can just move forward on it. If I look here at what has been said by the consultant, is that right here? 141. And from what I can see here, the consultant is saying the practitioner must take any necessary steps to rectify the matter and may direct the management to take appropriate steps. Is that the one we're going with? But we're all going along the same line. So in actual fact, we write back to where the number 7, but it's good sometimes to come in a circle. You can get the next one. Right. 86, 87. Let's see. We're surely coming to 141. Where was it? Was it 86? 86. That is the summary. And then page 15 of the response, 15, 16 of the proposal. Amend to exclude records held in terms of a search warrant. Ivanson's opinion is, I think that opinion is the 14th of February. That's why it's captured like that. Document 7 as well, page 15 and 16. So you've got them all here. And Doc 13, again. So, does DTI want to go first on this?
Sure, I don't know whether there's anything to further discuss. I think it has been done. It has been approved that copies should be made available. The people should have the right to go inspect.
Madam Chair, just for the sake of the reference, document 30, it's at the top of page 90. And the suggestion by Ms. Idenson has also been taken care of there.
So, you see, we worked then with this, it's all agreed. And that's now smooth running. And then we go to 87. Consider revising the fees of the... Well, haven't we dealt with fees? We've dealt with fees. And we don't want to revisit that. 88. You see, things overtake each other then. That 88, I don't know. Limitations. What is this? Page 69, summary, page 15, 16, of response. The limitations on both the amount and periods of preferential claims of employees should be implemented similar to those in the case of insolvency. Now, we're saying that there's a possible... Aren't in an agreement that there should be as much correlation as possible between the consequences of business residue and insolvency but ultimately a policy issue. Right. So, really, any further comments from DTI so we can move? We're making good progress.
Chair, we don't think there's any necessity to do this change. I think the act currently stands is in order, at least until we do a first revision of the old act in 2 or 3 years' time.
Sorry. That is the one in a second there on page 13. And it refers to 145.4. We can get something on page 7 of the second response, and we've got page 7 of the second response, don't we? Just want to see that. Right. The DTI disagrees this matter was debated. This was NEDLAC, and the DTI proposed to Parliament, and it was adopted when the bill was processed. It was debated by NEDLAC, on which so many people do sit, the civil society, etc. It was disagreed with there, 145. I wonder if we just take a look there. Are you still of the same opinion then? Can you just refresh our memories as to why? Because now we have our consultant agreeing with the stakeholder here. So it would be helpful if she could hear your view or opinion.
Sure, I don't think I'll have to, I need to go into the merits of the agreement. I think the matter of fact is we stood by the position as it is because it has actually been resolved with all stakeholders at that point in time when the act was passed. It hasn't been implemented yet. Nobody has had any problem with it yet. This is the first time that we've gotten another proposal now because the bill was on the table and the initial agreement has not yet been put into operation.
I'm happy to refer to the collective opinion of all the stakeholders as expressed by the DTI.
Right, so in fact we'll just stay with DTI on that point, so I hope we just give that a tick, all right? Fine. And we then go to the next NA, and that is also there. The practitioner should be able to either admit or reject proof of claims by creditors. Addison agrees with DTI that the section only deals with procedures at the first meeting, so we shouldn't be anywhere near that kind of thing. So we just move, all right? We're moving on that one. Now we come to page 7071 of the summary. Clarify whether the intention of subsection 2 is to allow the company or affected person rejecting the business rescue plan to give notice at the meeting if an application to court will be made to set aside the vote. The meeting should be adjourned, etc., etc., 5 days. The applicant 5 days business day to make the application. If the application is made, the matter is adjourned until further until the court has disposed of the application. That was... let me just see further on. That was section 153.2. We do have, I'm not sure what DTI has said here. Let me just check. Don't know if we had a DTI position there at all. But we do have what Ivanson has marked, said here. Is that also in 13? Ms. Ivanson, in document 30.
No, it's not.
But we have to read this here. If a business rescue plan has been rejected as contemplated in X, the practitioner may seek a vote of approval from the holders of voting interest to prepare and publish a revised plan. Advise the meeting that the company will apply. So this is quite a long, drawn-out one. If the practitioner does not take any action contemplated in paragraph A, any affected person present at the meeting may call for a vote, etc., advise the meeting that an application will be made, and it goes on at length, and I must assume this came from the stakeholder. Is that right? Has DTI had a chance to study this?
We did initially look at it. We did initially look at the presentation of this particular commentator. Unfortunately, we had the idea that he was trying to revise the whole process before it had been created and put into practice. And it was so we didn't really consider whether it would, we considered and said it, we do not see the necessity of this provision. And we didn't want to consider going into changing the whole business rescue process and approval of the business rescue plan with insertion of this. I think it's a matter of policy up to the committee whether we'll have to go into the whole process of approval of the business plan and whether alternative processes are actually necessary.
Members, as you can see, if you look at the principle Act 153 there, failure to adopt a business rescue plan. And there are detailed points made there. It is pretty, pretty long. We've heard what DTI has to say. I think it would be unfair to simply say, jump with this. We may want to say, look, we have an opinion from our consultant. Can we get the chance to read it for ourselves? I'm just making a proposal here from the chair. And then, as we consider, we can take that on board there. On the spot?
Chair, I would like to agree with your proposal. Thank you.
Can we agree with that? So, at this
particular point, there are only two flagged issues. Swift and this one. We're not dealing, all right? Okay, so we now move on. And we go to 91. Amend to include a person performing the function of an internal audit. That applies to see page 48 of the summary. What is it they actually want? It's section 1593. Protection for whistleblowers. Okay. So it's the protection for whistleblowers. It's 3A. Is it? 3A. Line, page 270, line 1. That is there at the top, right at the top. It is made in good faith to the Commission. Is that what we're talking about, Ms. Hurling? Is that what we're talking about? If we've all got it in front of us, and as we are making very good progress, notwithstanding I know how long people have been here. Now we have the consultant, our consultant agrees with the stakeholder. Members, this is the whistleblower issue here, and so but it refers in particular to one section here. Can we just get your verbal, can you speak to it here now, please, Ms. Ivanson?
The stakeholder had simply suggested that the whistleblowing provision should also cover situations where information is disclosed not only to a director or any of the other already listed persons, but also to anybody who was performing the function of an internal audit, and I'm saying I agree with that.
Grigio.
No problem. We've got the problems on the other side. Do we agree?
Our consultant just to put off something there. Fine. So that's really the issue on that one. And then we come to 97. Whether the shareholders by agreement can contract out of the rights under section 164, etc. Exclusion of payments to a shareholder exercising appraisal rights under section 164 from the solvency and liquidity test may prejudice other stakeholders in the company who would otherwise be protected by the test. So that is section 164. On the committee's decision here, comments, shareholders' appraisal rights where solvency and liquidity will be compromised, there must be a court application, DTI. Agree with Idenson's opinion dated the 14th of Feb. Agreed?
Yes.
Fine. 99. Page 50, summary, right, and that is section 166. The consequential change in section 169, according to the amendment of section 166.1.
Yeah. 169
is on 294. And just so that I can get my head around this one, it is a consequential change in section 169.1b according to the amendment already made, presumably in 166. All right? Add in or person after that agency. So, Ms. Idenson, just speak to that briefly.
This suggested amendment of adding in the word. The suggestion that the words all persons should be added came from somebody else, I'm not sure from whom, and I've approved it. I think that that is a change that does need to be made. Consequentially, it's not a substantive issue at all.
It's not substantive, but it can probably benefit from a change. Shall we move with that? Shall we move? Yes. And then we come to NA again below that, which is section 185. The CIPRO, what is it? Special measures should be introduced to restore confidence in the ability of CIPRO to fulfill its role. Believe you me, I think this act is designed with all of that in mind, I hope. I see you looking at me skeptically, but we hope with this act we will be able to address a number of issues. So I'm looking to see who's making any comment here. You know, there's no comment here from DTI, anyone else. Members, I honestly think the act itself, in its entirety, you know, should address those issues. So can we move with that, please? And when you get to consideration after discussing this with your party principals, you come back. Is that fair enough? Okay. We're not adopting it yet. Okay. NA 105. Additional clause. To provide the term of service for members of the tribunal and to allow these to serve a second term. I think that's already captured in document 6-7. It's already addressed. It was raised by some of us as well. Clause 113. That's section 218. The wide application, etc., must give rise to vexatious claims and unsubstantiated malicious claims being initiated against directors and officers. Idenson agrees with DTI. The risk is not not peculiar to this provision. The courts guard against this. So, right, we just move on that one again, too. Thank you. 118. under 118, Carrie Father's par value, we actually dealt with that and accepted it. We dealt with that whole issue on par value. We did get a further proposal and we adopted it, we accepted that. So can we move, please? The summary. A specific section dealing with the appointment of an independent accounting professional to perform the review should be introduced in the Act. Idemson defers to the accounting profession's opinion. So, in other words, I think, from what I understand with Idemson, you're saying, well, let's hear what they're about to say. What do you have to say, DTI?
The Act specifically provides that the Minister should make regulations on the whole issue of independent review and who the independent reviewers would be, the professors to be accredited and everything. So to now to put a single section in the Act dealing with the appointment of such a person, while the Act doesn't even identify the person, would be a bit, it's just not on. So it should be left to the regulations.
DTI's proposal to us and coming as a response would be to say, can we leave this in the regulations? Yes, Smollett, Honourable Smollett.
I think it's an order, ma'am.
Right. Now that we've had the underlining and the icing and everything else, you know why I was trying to do this? It was actually to help you as well. I didn't think that anyone wanted to come here and sit here off time. Are you here? I know Honourable Kamal has sent a special request for me to stay on Friday, but, I think all of us have got a lot of other work to do. But before you escape, can we just hear the way forward, please? There is a lot of work that still needs to be done on the side of Secretariat. We will be liaising with our own consultants and ETI. Right. You want to just take us forward now, Mr. Herman.
I think the process forward, I think we have discussed with ETI and Secretariat, is that we have the agreement, in principle agreement of members of the amendments they would like to see within the amendment bill. What we will do is to prepare the A and B bill, and when we return on Wednesday, to have that A and B bill in front of the committee. It will not be maybe the book in the bill as it is, but it will be a copy of the proof that we would have received from Peter. Our intention is by tomorrow to have a full A list as approved by the State Law Advisor in terms of all the legal requirements that need to happen. When we receive that, we will start with the process of doing the A and B bill, and we will probably get proof on Friday. We'll check to read the proofs in consultation with DTI and State Law Advisor. Maybe ask the second round of proofs if there's many errors or mistakes on the bill, and hopefully Monday we will correct all those outstanding errors. So when we come back on Wednesday, we will have hopefully as correct a and B bill as we would want to have it, subject to obviously approval, and because we may have on Wednesday proposed changes to that A and B list, which will then factor in. So that would be the process for it.
What date is Wednesday next week?
The 9th.
So the thing is that already we need to factor in the 10th as a request, just in case, you know, we as a contingency plan forward. All right? So we're looking at the 9th, that's right, with everything we've discussed, etc., separated now. But the point is, when is the consideration? It was supposed to be on the 9th. Now that will be the formal consideration. The formal consideration does mean we've got two issues that are flagged. Remember? The one issue It would have been great if we could have resolved on Tuesday afternoon earlier. Then, aren't we all here on Tuesday afternoon late? Is the house sitting? Because the house was sitting.
And we need to be in the house.
And we need to be in the house anyway for that, you know, request to go through. So I'm just saying that I'm just looking at the time we have before us. If we feel confident that if we started early and we got through that on the consideration, would we complete it on Wednesday? No. We may not. I'm just saying, you have to consider that. Yes.
Potentially there would be only two issues that we need to re-look at, that is the issues that is flagged. And technically, it becomes a technical method, issue that we need just to alter, which is we will alter subject to your approval. So if the committee approves it, we will alter it and then we can ask for a print, but we will do it subject to your signing up on that.
So members, there we are. We will meet then on Wednesday. I will ask, though, for Friday to be put in, just as a contingency anyway, so that there's no alarm created later. I don't expect us to use Friday for that purpose. I hope I'm clear. So, yes, Honourable Salaf?
We then agree, Chair, that the request that we earlier agreed upon will be made in on the Tuesday sitting.
The request is at the first sitting, and that first sitting is Tuesday. It is regarded, I'm told, by the procedures officer that a matter, a routine matter almost, is not likely to be opposed by those of us who actually want the amendments, and we all want the amendments, I take it, because we're all going to be adopting these amendments, you see. You know, when I say adopting them, we put them forward. Up to now, there are two outstanding issues. There's SWIFT, and there's the other one we just didn't have the time to read. It wasn't that we were opposing it, but it would have been unfair to keep you here. All right? So that is the basis forward. But it must go there, I believe. Now, I don't want to delay you any further. It's 1:40, rather. I'd like to thank DTI for really being with us, and I know that you will continue to be here next week, I hope. And we would hope that also the DDG will join you then as well, as I think she has indicated she will. And members, Ms. Idenson, thank you very, very much for support, the support that you have given us professionally. Ms. Hurling, Mr. Hermans, Mr. Zabili, better than I try and murder your surname or family name. And most of all, members. And the only reason other members aren't here is they had to go to this workshop or whatever it was. So thank you. Please let's all be here Wednesday for the consideration. Thank you. I wonder if Ms. Vandermeer or Sue would